a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
All right, let's bring the second meeting of the Bureau of Administration Agency Review to order. And let's see here. Do we have a quorum? We'll go ahead and call the roll.
Ahlers, Fikert,
here.
Kirkaby, Merchant, Putnam,
here.
Solberg,
here.
Teason,
here.
Wink, Wismer,
here.
Haverly,
here.
Rave,
here.
Have a quorum.
We barely have a quorum. Approval of minutes. Do we have a motion to approve the minutes from last meeting? Representative, moved by Putnam.
Second.
Second by Solberg. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion carries. Minutes are approved. Senator Ahlers is here. Well, Chair and Vice Chair remarks. Mr. Vice Chair, you want to just welcome everybody, and Commissioner, welcome back, and I think we'll just get right into it unless anyone else has any business we need to attend to before we start the day. Doesn't appear so. Commissioner, you're back on.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to come back again. We're going to continue right down the agenda that you have in front of you, and our first presentation will be from Dennis Rounds, who runs risk management. Dennis is a, I believe, he got a longevity check here not long ago for 29 years of state employment. His job actually combines two former positions. He previously was the executive director of the Petroleum Release Fund. He continues to do that, but also is our manager with risk management. And with that, I'll ask Dennis to come on up, and he'll
excellent.
Give his presentation.
He's been here 29 years. He still looks 27.
Thank you.
Good morning, Dennis.
Morning. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to update you on the public entity pool for liability in the Office of Risk Management. We've got some slides here, a very brief PowerPoint to kind of go over some of the fundamentals of our program, just so you have a general idea of what we do. First of all, on the first slide, you'll see just what we are, and it's primarily a public entity pool for liability. This is authorized under South Dakota Codified Law 322, which sets up, it's not insurance, but like insurance, to provide liability coverage to all state employees. This was necessitated by the lack of insurance. Basically, the private insurance just bailed. They don't like public entities. They're hard to insure. They're very high risk. And for the lack of insurance, I think the state, like a lot of the counties and other public entities did, is set up their own pools back in the 80s, and that's what the state did. And I think the big thing on this is we provide liability coverage to all state employees, including constitutional offices and you guys with the legislator as well, and also to specific volunteers when they're working on behalf of the state. So it's pretty broad coverage. Some of the things that we do in our office, we administer the People Fund, as it's called. We deal with all the claims and the lawsuits that arise as a result of that. We have a pretty aggressive loss control program to try to minimize those claims and minimize accidents and bad behavior, if we can call it that. We do safety inspections on all of the state, most of the state buildings, and on also all the state's leased buildings. We do the same thing at the universities as well, just to make sure people are following code and there isn't any risks down there. And we kind of look at them with a little different eye than maybe what a facilities and grounds person would. We purchase the insurance for the state, and just so you know, most state buildings are not insured. However, the regional facilities are all insured, and then there's a few other things like the revenue-generating buildings that the Game Fish and Parks manages, and the governor's residence is insured. But the rest of the state buildings have no insurance. We also purchase the boiler insurance for all state facilities, aviation insurance, and we do a crime bond for state employees. And then that's all handled by our office. A couple other things we do that aren't quite as extensive, we handle the ergonomic program for state employees. This is to make sure that they're all working in a safe environment and have comfortable workstations. We have people who do assessments and provide advice as to how they can sit better, stand better, reconfigure the vehicle or the equipment so that it suits them better. And then lastly, we do litigation services for the governor. This really is to put our hands around all the legal services within state government. We'll make sure that we try to minimize the number of attorneys that are hired by state government and get a better control on their costs and what they do. And as a result, all legal services have to be approved by our office. When possible, we'll go to some of the same firms. We'll also set up what we call master contracts, which are we'll hire some firms and we'll do a contract with them through the People Fund. But then if, say, Game Fish and Parks need an attorney for a very special project, a one-time project, they can go to that firm with nothing more than a letter of engagement. So it makes it easy for them to contract with them. We went from about 230 some odd attorneys to about 70 in the past couple of years. Generally, our mission is to protect the state's assets and protect the state's reputation. And again, we want to ensure a safe environment for both the public who are coming onto state property and with our employees who are working here every day. Minimize the interruption of vital services. And with regard to claims and lawsuits, we try to get on them right away. Resolve them if we can. If not, go in and defend them in court. And again, one of our major parts of our program is that loss control program where we do training and work with all the state agencies to try to minimize any exposures they have. Being a small agency of 5 employees and trying to reach out to all the agencies, we don't have any authority over them. All we can do is ask for them to make changes, which isn't always easy. And so one of our goals is our outreach vision here, and what we want to do is sort of permeate all state agencies, develop some trust with them so that they'll listen and understand what we're looking for. And I think we've been pretty successful with that over the past few years. The big thing is to have everybody thinking in terms of risk in addition to what they normally think of all the time. And then when they do that, I think we're going to minimize the accidents and the lawsuits that we're going to encounter. And you'll see at the bottom of that slide, I got a phrase here that our philosophy in really one phrase is good leadership is good risk management. Yeah, we want to do the safety issues and everything else, but it all comes from the top. As we all know, if you've got a good leader, then you're going to be a good supervisor. You're going to take care of your employees. You're going to minimize accidents. You're also going to ensure a safe environment and so on. So we try to go to the top of it all and to assure good leadership, and we do this in various ways through programs and so on. Just a little statistics on what, you know, kind of a scope of our program. We provide $1 million in liability coverage per each occurrence. So if there was 20 occurrences a year and they're all at limits, we would have to pay out $20 million in lawsuits and in indemnities. But it includes auto liability, general liability, there's some errors and omissions, medical malpractice, and so on. So generally, if we have one lawsuit that's at limits, it's $1 million. Most of them are not. Most of them are much less, but the maximum is $1 million. State employees are not responsible for any indemnity above $1 million. Assuming we would have a lawsuit against one of our state employees and the jury would award $2 or $3 million, by statute, they are only liable up to the amount of our coverage, which is $1 million. Now, likely there hasn't been anything like that in the history of this program, but there is kind of a safety net there. There's also, in the bottom of this slide, there's what we've paid out over the 23 years the program's been in place, and it's been $30.5 million, and that includes not just the indemnities and the damages for auto accidents and for other types of liability claims, but also the expenses and administration and so on. So while that's a big number, over 23 years, comparatively speaking, it's really pretty small. My predecessor, Judy Payne, who ran this program, did an excellent job and kind of set a good trend. And so we've been pretty lucky here in South Dakota.
Dennis, how does that compare to other states on a percentage basis, the liability that other states end up paying out?
Well, it's difficult to compare. For example, Wyoming, we try to once in a while, but their pool not only covers state employees, but it also covers law enforcement from county and city, and that's a huge difference. And they do so as they would have a lot more liability and pay a lot more in claims, and it wouldn't really be a fair comparison of state governments. Other states are the same way. They're all a little different. But I really couldn't tell you, you know, what the numbers are.
No, that's fine. I just spur of the moment thought of it. So, any other questions at this point? Oh, okay. Go ahead, Dennis.
Just kind of a little follow-up on this thing. One of the safety factors we have is immunity to state employees, you know, both our lawmakers, judicial, there's judicial immunity, and state employees have immunity from lawsuits as long as their actions were discretionary. And discretionary means, you know, they're using their judgment. So supervisors and department secretaries and things, if they make a decision to establish a policy to have snow plows go out at 5 in the morning, that's a discretionary task. However, the guy who's supposed to be driving the snow plow, who's following the direction, that's a ministerial task. So if you're driving a car down the highway, that's a ministerial task. If you run a stop sign and injure a third party, that there would not be immunity for that. But if you were the one who said, we're going to pull our snow plows back, we can't go out because there's a blizzard, and as a result, somebody was stranded on the highway and died, that would have been a discretionary decision, and we would have immunity from a lawsuit in that kind of a case, which just makes sense. I just want to bring that up. There's some statutory immunities, too. For example, the judicial, the UJS, they have statutory immunity for a lot of their actions. The Department of Transportation has statutory immunity for anything resulting from design work, and so on. So there's immunities in place, too, that protects us. So what this program does, you know, along with our immunities, the People Fund protects the employees of South Dakota.
Okay. Great.
So I'd ask if there's any questions.
Good. Any questions? Go ahead, Senator Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you quantify in approximations the number of lawsuits and the number of claims on an annual basis, approximately?
Yeah. In fact, they stay... The vehicle claims have dropped over the years substantially, but it's not a lot every year. Vehicle claims may be around 100, and general liability claims around 200. But it can go up size 400 and so on, because it varies. You know, we just don't know what's going to happen.
Dennis, what are most of the vehicle claims? Are they just like a fender bender? I mean, you know, in town, somebody runs a red light, or not even runs a red light. They just hit an intersection. Are those typical claims?
Those are typical claims.
Okay.
We do have the major ones. In fact, our largest one was a gentleman, unfortunately, ran a stop sign and hit a vehicle with three elderly people in there. And while nobody died, the circumstances were that the medical costs were basically at limits.
So the state ended up covering all their medical costs?
All their medical costs, okay. Right. So it can be a fender bender with $1,000 damage, or it could be $1 million.
Right.
But most of those are the smaller ones, numerically.
Good. Representative Feikert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Could you use your microphone? I'm sorry, just so it goes on the internet. Thank you.
Can you give us an example of a medical malpractice? I noticed that on the deal.
Right. We also provide this coverage to the universities, which includes the University of South Dakota Medical School. And if there was an incident where one of the doctors, as a professor, was doing some work and there was some medical malpractice, we'd provide coverage. And that would take some kind of review to determine whether or not it fell under his private insurance or our insurance. But there are times when we'd provide that coverage.
Okay. And Senator Tease and then Representative Putnam.
Thank you. Just to follow up, approximately how many of those claims might end up in a lawsuit being filed? Again, an approximation on an annual basis.
Yeah, there's about 8 to 10 a year that end up in a lawsuit. About, if I took a snapshot 10 years ago today, there was 70 active lawsuits going on at that time. Right now we have 38 active lawsuits. So the numbers drop down substantially, and I think a big reason for that is inmate lawsuits are particularly persistent. Mm. But as we've learned to deal with them better and better and get rid of them faster and faster, the numbers drop down. And also with just the automobile practices and the practices within state government that have changed substantially in the past, you know, 5-6 years, and as a result, we're just getting less and less lawsuits. I think also since we've won many of them, people are less likely to challenge.
Representative Putnam.
The
recollection that I have of a number of years ago that we had a loaded gravel truck that belonged to DOT going down a hill and rear-ended a civilian car sitting, or a citizen's car sitting at a stoplight, in which there was a great deal of damage. Maybe that was one of them you were talking about. But it did result in quite a lawsuit to the state, and we were handling it accordingly. It was learned by the plaintiffs, if you will, that although the medical bills and so forth are paid for, conscious pain and suffering are not part of what we saw under our people or under the fund somehow or other. And then, in turn, a bill was brought to the legislature to offset or to pay for some of those things. I don't know if that's been changed. I only remember that coming to the appropriations process and the plaintiffs asking for taxpayer dollars for conscious pain and suffering, even though the medical bills were paid, as Representative Ray was talking about, and you agree that that's normally done in a case like that. Is something changed, or is that still remaining the same with regard to our exemption from having to go through that?
No, we do pay and are authorized to pay pain and suffering. And I think there was a change as a result of that. And I don't know in that particular case if there was ever an appropriation made, but we can pay for pain and suffering. The one that we cannot pay for is punitive damages.
And just to follow up, if I may.
Please.
Is that the reason that we have the Extraordinary Litigation Fund? In other words, is there such a thing that sets out there that's above and beyond what we have the ability to take care of? Is that part of that?
Well, no, not necessarily. The Extraordinary Litigation Fund was set up to defend, like, actions the legislature would take that may be challenged by ACLU or Planned Parenthood or something. And also other areas where there's nothing but where there's a major lawsuit or major legal fees, and there isn't anything budgeted or anticipated. And so many of those lawsuits that we've handled under the Extraordinary Litigation Fund were legislative actions, and if we lose, we also have to pay plaintiffs' attorneys' fees. And they're very expensive.
Yes. Okay.
And then there's been other things like the tobacco litigation fund. We'll pay for the tobacco litigation, particularly the diligent enforcement on that, because that's pretty extraordinary costs, and those funds are very important to the state, so we'll put the money into it. And then there's been some other major lawsuits dealing with tribal issues that we've paid for that out of the Extraordinary Litigation Fund.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I have a question, and I thought it was going to be the last one, but I see Representative Solberg has his hand up. So, Dennis, would you tell us a little bit about, you had mentioned that a large percentage of the lawsuits are from inmates. Is that an area then in your department that you maybe work with the penitentiary and the other organizations that house inmates and look at potential areas that, I guess, where the state is at risk, for lack of a better term? So you go in and say, this particular situation, I can see the state could be exposed because the inmate is able to do this. And do you work on those types of situations then?
Yes, we do work with corrections because they are one of our highest exposures. But I have to say we've got a terrific Department of Corrections, and we don't find too many problems. Mm-hmm. Most of the lawsuits, and sometimes all the lawsuits, are really frivolous.
Okay.
They're filed in federal court, and in my opinion, most of them should be screened out, but they're not. Almost always we get them dismissed on summary judgment after we have to go through some limited discovery and everything else. But it's expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have so much time on their hands, they perpetually file stuff. And I won't go into this too much, but when they'll file a lawsuit, and then we'll file our answer and then begin preparing for summary judgment and getting the information, they will file motion after motion after motion after motion. And we have to wait for the judges to respond to those. And it can be months and months and months. And so we're dealing with discovery issues and other factors while we wait. So it can be very expensive in the defense, but we never lose.
Good. Thank you. Representative Solberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that you try to settle as many of the claims with your agency as possible.
Yes.
Without outside help. What percentage of the claims do you settle versus outside legal help?
Most. If we have, you know, 100 auto accidents a year, probably 99 of those would be settled in-house. When I say in-house, I'm talking, we have a claims adjuster, who we, an independent claims adjuster, who we contract with, because it wouldn't really be fair that, that, you know, I'm making the decision on the amounts. We want somebody independent. Most of those would be settled that way. General claims are a little different, those that aren't auto, and but still probably 70 to 75% or more are handled by outside help, you know, the adjuster or my office, and not legal help.
Good. All right. Anyone else? Okay. Thanks, Dennis. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Commissioner, looks like you're coming back up.
Mr. Chairman, committee, our next presentation will be by Jeff Holden, who is the head of our Office of Procurement Management. Just a little background, Jeff is also a longtime employee of the state. His expertise is pretty widely recognized across the country. He served as the president of the National Association of State Procurement Officers. He's still on their board of directors. In fact, I think they just flew him out to Washington for a trip here the last few days. So he's in touch with what's going on in a lot of other states in terms of their practices and trying to find ways to save money in conjunction with other states and other governmental entities. And so with that, I'll turn it over to Jeff Holden.
Good. Thank you. Welcome, Jeff.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning.
Members of the committee. Again, I'm Jeff Holden, Director of the Office of Procurement Management. I've been Director of Procurement Management for the last 11 years. Prior to that, I was in multiple programs in state government and a wide variety of things I've done. So I just want to talk a little bit. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about procurement management because it's not something that people hear too much about until there's a problem. So it's nice to talk about it when we can tell you what we do. Procurement management, or procurement, public procurement, is a process for budgeting funds and acquiring goods and services. It contains at least three stages that we're involved in, more stages than that because you guys are involved in the budgeting part of it. We don't deal with the budgeting, but we deal with the communication with the agencies to determine their needs. We do that by when we have a planned procurement, we ask them for their estimates of their needs so that we can let vendors know what to expect in purchases and try to get better pricing. We also look at what they're asking for and determine the appropriate sourcing method. So it may be, with our new law, we now have the ability to do invitations for bids or competitive sealed proposals. And some sourcing requirements would lean more toward the RFP process. And then our other role is to administer established contracts. So we have approximately 450 annual contracts. And when I say that, those are contracts for goods, but there may be multiple suppliers under each of these categories of goods. So each of those is considered a contract, each supplier. Why are we important? As you know, I don't have to tell you that the state spends a lot of money on goods and services. Our role is we have a direct approval role in the procurement of goods. We have an advisory role in the procurement of services. There's no requirement that agencies send their contracts for services to procurement for approval. But we do assist them if they ask us to conduct the process of the RFP. And we also assist them in posting their RFPs to the public solicitation board so that the public knows that there are opportunities out there. We implemented any procurement system that we use to post that and notify any registered bidder of those opportunities. But the agencies can decide to handle those processes themselves from receipt of the proposals through award. Okay. What we do is we try to safeguard public funds by maintaining the integrity of those processes. So we make sure that the law is followed. If there's administrative rules in place, that those are followed. Sometimes agencies don't like that we make them follow the processes, but it's something that we have to do. As far as efficiency and effectiveness, what we try to do, our goal is to get agencies to get the right products at the right price at the right time. When I first started, our standard delivery on an annual contract was 30 days. the world has changed now. Most contracts are just-in-time delivery, so it may be two-day delivery or next-day delivery in some cases. And we have several of those. We've made several of those changes on our big contracts. Public confidence, we understand that the public wants things to be done ethically. So by making sure that agencies follow the processes and that our bids are done that way, we can ensure public confidence. And also supplier confidence. The suppliers have to believe that what we're doing is fair to them as well as to our agencies. So we have a little balancing act to make sure that we're meeting the needs of the agencies, but also being fair to our suppliers. Public policy and the law. We provide guidance and training to our agencies so that they understand what the law is. Many times, we just recently did some meetings across the state because of the new procurement code, and a two-hour, three-hour training isn't enough, so you have to continue to do that. But we had some good attendance at those, and we hope that that will be effective. We also...
Jeff, we have a question. Representative Putnam.
That was okay. I just wanted to get to you before we went to the next slide. The as you know, for example, BIT, who needs a lot of specialized and technical equipment within their own organization, they have a group of citizens and other folks in that make a decision on what should be purchased in that area and how much dollars. Are you part of that? Do you sit on that situation, or do you sit on that board that decides a certain amount of things that should be procured for those agencies?
Please. Mr. Chairman, I don't sit on the board. I do have an IT buyer, a purchasing specialist that works directly with BIT, and we are involved with them. We communicate with them. They establish state standard products. We establish the contracts. Excuse me. So we administer many of the contracts for supplies, not for services necessarily. They do their own service contracts. But we are involved in the process of working with the contractors that provide the products that have been established to state standard.
If I could follow up. If social services required something in their agency that didn't have anything to do with BIT, and I'm talking about technology because that's the only one that I can recall that has a group sits together and decides on how much should be spent there. If they have, do they sit with you and then you agree or not agree on the agency's idea of what they need? In other words, your second one, efficiency and effectiveness, you're talking about making sure that the best bang for the buck. How do we get to know that with your folks and procure items for large agencies such as social services?
When it comes to IT products, computer hardware, software, is exempt from the procurement code, so we don't have authority over it. BIT takes that authority. They may ask us to conduct a bid for it, and we would do that. We do have, we do have many cooperative contracts that we are participating in for computer hardware, software, through the Western States Contracting Alliance and the National Association of State Procurement Officials for all the computer manufacturers, printers, and that type of thing. So if it gets into some specialized IT equipment, we may have to do some other sourcing method. But BIT may do a sourcing effort on their own or do a negotiation because it's not required to be competitively bid.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Haverly.
I didn't follow that last, but repeat that whole last answer because I didn't follow quite what you were saying with the procurement outside of the state.
The other contracts. South Dakota belongs to a couple of procurement alliances, one being the Western States Contracting Alliance, which is basically the western region of the National Association. South Dakota and Minnesota are part of the Western States Contracting Alliance, but we're also part of the Midwestern region. So we're kind of cross regions because of our location.
Follow up.
Go ahead, please.
So if an outside agency or an outside, I shouldn't say outside agency, if an outside vendor wants to propose something that is within the state standards, what's the process? I mean, you're not on contract with the Western States Contracting Alliance, correct? You're not obligated to go to them first.
Right. No, they're not mandatory contracts. They're convenience contracts, but they use South Dakota companies as resellers, most of them, For example, Hewlett-Packard. If you're a South Dakota company that sells Hewlett-Packard products, you're eligible to sell to government agencies through that contract. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I think you're missing what my question is. If I was a vendor and I had a brand new computer and I came to the state and I said, I can reduce your prices, what is the process for that vendor to be able to utilize your system? If you're, for lack of a better expression, if you're in bed with the Western States Alliance, then how does an outside vendor come in and be able to put in a bid?
Yeah.
Okay.
The main criteria is a state standard that BIT establishes. So once they establish a standard, we establish a contract, whether it be from the WSCA or from an outside vendor. So once we establish that state contract, then it's a state standard, and there's a challenge process that anybody can participate in that we post on our website. So after a certain period of time, it's exclusive contract for a certain period of time, and then it can be challenged by any vendor.
I think that now you've nailed it down. And then the state, I'm sorry, Mr.
Please,
Chair.
No,
and the state standard, as you mentioned, that is just that BIT would have no responsibility for establishing a contract. You're the legal end or the paperwork end. Is that?
I don't know that I would go that far. Because of the exemption for computer hardware and software, BIT does have a lot of authority on who is the state contract holder. So when we get a challenge, we would work with BIT to make sure that what's challenged or offered in the challenge meets the standard. So they would do an evaluation, and they pretty much would make the decision whether or not it's acceptable as the contract.
Representative Wismer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you've made a reference a couple of times to a new law. Did I hear that? But you're not talking about 1260 from 09, are you? Because that's just services.
No, I'm talking about we did a complete rewrite of the procurement code this year. I forgot the number. 1046. House Bill 1046. Replaced the old procurement code with new language, which contained a lot of the old procurement code, but some new language as well. So there's some changes, but it just kind of organized the code so it's more easy to follow.
And you said you don't handle... there aren't any services. So 1260 from 09 didn't affect how you operate at all, because that's just all of those decisions are made at the agency level.
1260 for the professional services put the responsibility on the agencies to compete their service, professional service contracts. We have some involvement in there because that statute directly required the agency to post their opportunities on our e-procurement system. So what they do is they send them to us, and then we post them and notify vendors of the opportunity. Now, the agency can come to us and say, we'd like you to run the process for us and do the solicitation, and we will do that if they ask. And some have.
Good. All right. Please continue, Jeff. Thanks.
Some of the specific functions that we do on a day-to-day basis, we establish and maintain bidder lists. Right now, we do maintain our bidder list through our e-procurement system. We have a $50 annual fee that is required to be a registered bidder. We do have some opportunities to add bidders for a one-time bid if it's appropriate for free, so we don't block anybody out. And if you don't have to be a registered bidder to bid, but you do have to be registered to bid online. So we would send them a copy of the bid solicitation, and they would send us a paper bid if they weren't registered. We look to locate new sources of supply. One of the things that we have to look at whenever we receive a bid, we try to benchmark against other contracts that are out there, including WSCA, the NASPO cooperative contracts. There are a whole bunch of other consortiums that are out there that are establishing contracts. So if we find the same bidder that we have on one of those contracts, we try to compare the pricing and see if we're eligible to use that contract if it's better than our bids. We monitor vendor performance on their contracts to make sure that they're meeting the requirements. We also send notifications to bidders of our contracting opportunities. We do that in a couple of ways now. We have our e-procurement system allows us to send an email notification to anybody registered for a specific commodity, or we are also post our opportunities on a public board that if they're not registered, they can go look at the board. If they see something, they can contact us. We receive, open, and tabulate bids and proposals. So for those that we are handling the solicitation, for any supplies, we would do that. For any services that an agency has asked us to do it, we would evaluate, help them evaluate and tabulate their bids and proposals. We handle bid and performance security if it's required. The new statute that was passed made bid and performance bonds for procurement of supplies and services permissive and not mandatory. We will use them in certain circumstances, but utilize other types of security if appropriate. Again, we administer state contracts. This would include enforcement of contract price adjustment requirements. We sometimes have vendors like to adjust prices without telling us, so we have to deal with that. So we make sure that they've gotten appropriate approvals and provided the proper documentation.
Jeff, excuse me, do you do that then also on the contracts that, like the ones we were talking about, that you don't have the, that maybe you don't set up, like the ones from BIT, but are you kind of the watchdog of those contracts once they're in place? Would that be a fair statement?
Yes, once they're in place, we handle the price adjustments.
Okay.
The vendor will notify us of price adjustments, and we make sure that they've complied with whatever their contract says.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. We handle complaints from agencies about vendors as well. One of the primary things that we do daily is reviewing agency requisitions for non-contract purchases. So we make sure that they've followed the process by obtaining quotes, appropriate quotes, as required by the law. Make sure they were competitive as much as the law requires, and then we will issue a purchase order in that case.
Question?
Yes, Representative Putnam.
An example of that from some agency, would it be like we need special scissors in a certain agency? I mean, what does that mean? It isn't a large bid across the state or anything that you could use
right
in your alliance to get a good deal on. What would that amount to that might be something that you could tell us about that would
sure
be efficient?
I'll give you an example. One that was done recently was a floor scrubber for Northern State University, probably a $5,000 item. They would go out and obtain quotes from suppliers, local, usually close local suppliers, to provide a floor scrubber. And the law allows them to do that if they get three quotes. We would review the quotes, make sure that they're appropriate, they don't have adverse terms and conditions from the vendor that the state wouldn't agree to. And if everything's okay, then we'll issue a purchase order to that vendor.
Based on that, you okay that request or that PO, whatever you're calling it, and then it's procured under your say-so, and the request is sent to you by, for example, the university?
That's correct. They submit it to us. For non-university purchases, all the requisitions flow through our electronic system. They have their own system, and we have... They have set us up as approvers within their system, so we do it through their system, but it's basically the same process.
Thank you.
Good. Thank you. Okay, go ahead, Jane. Thanks, Jeff.
Okay. Then we prepare bid and proposal documents as required and distribute to the registered bidders, and we ensure that anything that's required to be advertised is publicly advertised as required by the law. And again, we issue purchase orders approximately... counting the universities and our own, we've issued 5,000 purchase orders a year. And then we communicate with vendors regarding state government processes and tell them how they can do business with us. We do that through our vendor manual, and then we, from time to time, we'll have vendor meetings. So we feel that the functions performed by our office are best performed by a central agency. Because it gives a single point of contact for vendors and agencies when they have questions about how to conduct business appropriately. So I'd be happy to answer any more questions.
Good. Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Any further? Senator Allers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question about the bidding process and some complaints that were lodged to me by constituents. And I've talked to Commissioner Bloomberg a little bit about it, but I need to be able to explain this to, going back to my constituents, why this happens. But on, I know at least two occasions, facilities within the regions needed tuck pointing done. And the bids, the requests for bids were put out, bids were brought in, and then after all these contractors have bidded, the job's awarded to inmates at the prison. And the reason this is a problem is because here you have all these private people that we've asked to do bid, and there's a cost to doing this bidding process, and then we just turn it over to the prison. You know, I guess I need to understand why we do this, and are we really saving money doing it this way, and are we jeopardizing our relationships with our contractors?
Commissioner, looks like you're going to handle this one.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, and I will probably ask Christy Honeywell if she needs to fill in the facts here, who is the state engineer. For going back well into the Janklow administration, tuck pointing crews and roofing crews were created as a way to do two things, try to save some money on those repairs, tuck pointing and roofing for state buildings, as well as work for inmates. I think that's kind of was the secondary goal. Those programs still continue at the prisons. And I think, and again, I'd have to ask Christy this exact date, but about a year or so ago, a contractor wrote a letter to the governor essentially saying, you know, when you have inmates working on those projects, you're taking away work from the private sector, which is true, and also that I could do it cheaper, the private sector could do it cheaper than the inmates. So in an effort to determine whether that was true or not, on I don't know if it was just one project or, well, let Christy, we decided to do a, let's find out if that's true. Are we saving money with the inmates or not? So the reason, or the decision was made to put the project or projects out on bid to find out, is the prices that we would get from the private sector comparable, more or high or low, et cetera, than what we are getting from the inmates? And that was the reason for that limited situation. Then I'll let Christy kind of finish the rest of the story.
Mr. Chairman.
Please.
Senator, basically what we did is we took a project that we knew needed to be done in the future. It was the tuck pointing project at the School for the Deaf. And we did put it out for bid. And we ended up having two bidders on it. And the low bid was approximately $162,000 to complete that. What I asked Corrections to do separately from that, you know, they didn't know what that bid was to give me an estimate what it would cost the tuck pointing crews to do it. And they came back and told me it was about $65,000. So because it we did find out that it did save us, it would have saved us, you know, $100,000, we decided at that time to reject all bids, which we are able to do. And our process now, we are in the process of completing that project using our tuck pointing crews.
Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm aware of that situation at SDSD, but it also occurred on our universities, too. And I guess if it's... what kind of message are we sending to these contractors? Were they made aware of this ahead of time, that this was an experiment to see if it was going to be cheaper to use them versus the prisons? I mean, are we communicating that to them? Because we're essentially competing with private enterprise, and we could have money turning over in the economy. Instead, we pay a little bit to our prisoners, and it pays a little bit for our prison costs, but we have contractors out of work that are looking for work right now. It seems counterproductive.
That's absolutely true. Can't argue with that, that there would be more money going into the contractors. On the other hand, that's $100,000 on that one project that we don't have to take from the taxpayers and that we can use for other projects that were appropriated for. So, I mean, it's a balancing test there. And we've gotten good value out of using those inmates. That's the bottom line. And this experiment, if you will, I think proved that fact. And our intent is to continue using those inmates doing the roofing and the tuck pointing with inmates as opposed to the private sector whenever we can and to the limits of the budget that's been set aside for that particular function, which, help me if I'm wrong, but I believe this fiscal year we've got $2.5 million.
For statewide M&R?
Yeah. No, I'm talking about just the...
about $200,000.
$200,000, right.
One more question to Senator Ahlers, then we'll go to Senator Haverly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not disagreeing that there's a value to putting the prisoners to work and teaching them skills, but at the same time, you say you saved $100,000, but did we really save $100,000 if we're paying people unemployment because they're not getting work? I'm just questioning that we have a lot of work that we could actually be passing out, and that money does turn over more than once, so there is a far greater impact than a savings of $100,000 to the state.
I don't know if it's far greater, but you're absolutely right. There would be some turnover, and there would also be the unemployment factor that you recognized.
Senator Haverly.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I missed something in the first part of it. So do you still go out for bid, even though you're using the Department of Corrections? You keep that within internal then?
Right. That was kind of one time, let's see if it... What the facts are, and so we're back to using those inmates when we can. When that $250,000 is shot, if we do have a roofing project, we would contract that out.
And follow up,
please.
I don't know. Well, I know this for a fact. DOC and the guys that are on work release, they wouldn't have work. A lot of them work for private contractors. I mean, I know many of them that work for heavy construction, just to name one that I know for sure, that are released and go out and do work. Do you know of any inmates that go out and work for private contractors on the particular situation that we were talking about?
No, I don't. I would have to look into that with corrections.
Well, and just to finalize on my last question, what was the comparison? It was...
I believe the number she quoted was 162 for the lowest bid, correct?
It was... Senator, I don't have the exact number, but it was approximately like 162.5, somewhere in there. For the low bidder, and our corrections can do it for approximately $65,000, so about $100,000.
Thank you.
Senator Merchant, welcome.
Hi, good morning. Thank you. I was wondering, do you have a list of all of the services that corrections may be offering to the state somewhere? Do we know how involved all of this is? You know, where it's direct, it's not a trustee that's actually working for the private sector, but we are, you know, hiring our correction services.
With the exception of the roofing crew, we use inmates in our department in custodial area, for example. You'll see them in this building today out on the grounds. John Deloche, when you go out to tour the fleet offices, you may go back where the cleaning bays are at. We use them out there. But we, relatively speaking, we use a very small number of inmates compared to their usage around the state. They're out there everywhere from Rapid City to Sioux Falls. And really, to get a good comprehensive list, we need to talk to corrections about that. But we use them wherever we can and wherever we feel that it's a safe and secure situation. I'll give you an example. We used to have them working down in the central mail area where you were a month ago. We had an occasion where we caught some of them stealing, literally taking the stamps off of of some of the mail, and because of that, we discontinue using inmates down there. If we can't trust them, then we don't want them down there, but we use them when we can.
Representative Putnam.
I didn't really have a question, but I could add to some of the conversation. The inmates are really, the DOC has control over that situation, but many times they're used in municipalities when storms come through. I know that we have had some debates up here with regard to people that do that job, salvage people, that don't have the opportunity to do that because we bring inmates in because the municipalities don't have the additional dollars, and so they don't go out for bid. One of the other situations that we use them on, as you recall, they wired all the schools. Most of the inmates did a lot of wiring for our schools, but they did it under contracting people, but we used that labor. So we always continually, and I agree with Senator Allers, many times that's a fine line that we walk, and the decisions have to be made. But up front, it would be easier if a system, when they bid, might be told somehow or other that this could be an inmate project that could be looked at by the state. So that might help some of the complaint that comes in, even on small objects. And I'll give you an example. Springfield is in my district. The Memorial Hospital at Tyndall wanted some work done, some work around the buildings and some rocks put in place and so forth. And this was some years ago, but the inmates were called to do this, which was a very capable opportunity. And I don't know if you were the secretary of the DOC at that time, but we had a call from one of the major folks in Yankton, South Dakota, that did this for a living. And so we did stop it. So there's some fine lines and some gray matter, but it would help when you put the bids out. There might be some little disclaimer somewhere that this is an opportunity for you to bid. However, the state does use inmate for doing jobs like that, and that would kind of quell some of the problems we have.
I think that's a good idea if we were ever to do that again. But as I said, the intent is to use the inmates where we can until that appropriation is used up, and then we would have to do something else.
Okay. And Representative Solberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That example that you used, 162,500 versus 65, were there any additional charges for supplies or anything that was needed for those, or was that the total cost?
That would be the total cost. We're required to calculate in our projects using inmates the cost of our supervision, the cost of the inmates, and the cost of the materials, and required to pay the excise tax that's involved with that amount, just like any other contractor would too.
Okay, great. Thank you, Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just make one more comment about the procurement. I think Jeff talked about the oversight that his office has, but I just wanted to point out that there's two other levels of oversight that are involved for state agencies in terms of the contracts. The second one, in addition to the Office of Procurement, is the State Auditor's Office, and they will review various expenditures that come through, some of them which have come through the contract process through Jeff's office. Then they go to the auditor's office. They will look those over, and on occasion they find issues that need to be addressed. And then the third level of oversight is the legislative audit, who will go back in and look at various contracts. You know, I can remember, this is probably a sore subject for Jeff, but I think about 5 years ago or somewhere in that range, there was an issue that legislative audit brought up regarding a purchase of a John Deere tractor, sole sourcing, and was that bid out? I think GOAC had a discussion about that. Yeah, I think he's very happy I brought that up. So there are three levels, you know, we try to provide each other the information each other need for to look over those contracts.
And GOAC is a warm and friendly little committee as well.
They are, sir.
Please. Actually, no. Just when I was talking about how we review the requisitions from the agencies, I wanted to mention that from time to time there are non-competitive requests that come in. So those would be under the sole source request or an emergency justification. We review those. We created forms for the agencies to fill out appropriate documentation, send to us. We review to see if it's complete and makes sense, and then we either approve or disapprove. The thing that we have started to do this year is when we get a sole source request that we aren't comfortable that it's completely sole source, we'll put out a public notice of our intention to sole source, and we'll put the agency justification, explain what's being requested, and allow anybody to complain that they can offer an equivalent product, then we'll put it out for bid if we get a complaint like that.
This is just a question out of my own ignorance because I don't deal in that realm, but how do people know? I mean, besides the website, I suspect you put it out a notice for bid then. Do you put it in newspapers? Or I mean, I don't see it because I don't deal in that, but...
Well, our invitations for bids and those types of things are put in a couple of newspapers statewide and on our website. The notice of intent for sole source, we just post on our public board and through the... We send it to all the registered bidders for that commodity in our system. So they would all see it if they're registered on our system, plus anybody that looks at our public board would see it.
Got it. Okay, good. All right. And Representative Wiss.
Chair, I too would appreciate a little help in answering a constituent concern on bidding procedures. In this particular case, it was lawnmowers, and his complaint, he had a maybe a newer type of style of product that he was trying to that he thought was superior, but of course the specs were written such that it had to be purple with 15 1/4-inch wheels, and so there was no way that his product could fit those whatever the specs were. How do you address those types of situations,
Mr. Chairman?
Please.
I'm not sure when that occurred time-wise, but the new statute has stricter requirements for the use of brand name specifications. So an agency that wants to limit to a brand name, or we can see that they've clearly used a brand name technical specification, we send it back to them now and say you need to use general performance specification, or you have to identify at least 3 different brands that are equivalent to what to your needs, meet your needs. So I may be familiar with the vendor that you're talking about, but we try to encourage agencies to allow as much competition as possible. From time to time, they do have a specific need for something to fit in a, for example, Game Fish and Parks that works in tree rows. It has to fit within that tree row, and if it's not the right width or size, it won't work. So those things have to be considered.
Excellent. Representative Solberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you have those 3 vendors that used as an example and they comply to the specs laid out, what criteria do you use then to choose the one that you do business with?
When an agency lists a brand name or equal specification, because in that case it would be brand name or equal, they list at least 2 other brands that are equal. So any of those 3, any dealer that provides any of those 3 brands and models are automatically acceptable. Now, if somebody else wants to offer an alternative product other than those listed, they still can. And then we require the agency to tell us why it's not equivalent. So we rely on the expertise of the agency and the person using the product. And if they can give us an adequate justification, then we either accept or not.
Go ahead.
But then how do you make the decision to make the final purchase? That's what I'm trying to get at.
Oh, in that case, it would be the low bid. The low bid meeting the specification.
Senator Merchant.
Thank you very much. Since you've been training people on the new procurement, I can't say that word, methods, do you have a fact sheet that you could disperse to us in some way? You know, something that just sort of siphons it down for us a little bit so we can take that to constituents to answer some of these questions?
I think I may have something that is that I prepared for the agencies. We do have the information that we used in our trainings posted on our website for anybody to access. It might be our PowerPoint presentation is there along with our manual or booklet that we handed out. So if that's okay.
Maybe, Sue, if you just put the link in the minutes, or if we could get that link in the minutes, that would be helpful.
Okay.
Good. All right. Well, thank you, Jeff. Appreciate it. Commissioner?
Our last area of program presentation deals with the fleet, Mr. Chairman, and I handed out a sheet that I thought that maybe you'd want to, if I could go over this before.
Please. Yes.
John Delosh gets going. One of the areas that gets brought up when we go to appropriations and in other forums is about this questions regarding the state's use of ethanol in various blends. And so I put together just a fact sheet for you front and back that details the amount of various types of fuels that we use. A couple points. Our fuel is purchased through Jeff Holden's office through the procurement process, and regularly state agencies are buying fuel for their various tanks. The BOA isn't involved in actually purchasing for our vehicles. We use DOT tanks, GFP tanks, and I think there's a couple smaller tanks that some of the agencies have around the state. So those agencies are going out to bid, and they will purchase the fuel through an open bid process. And it's being done every week. It's happening. My experience is when I started almost four years ago in this position, regular was the price that was coming in the lowest, and that's what the state purchased, just looking to save the state money through that contracting process. As of the last year, 2 years almost, it's been E10 has been under bid as opposed to regular. So that's caused the amount of E10 to rise over the last couple of years. And you can see the difference in FY10. There was, over 2 million gallons of E10 versus half a million of regular. Whereas those numbers were kind of turned around a couple years ago. As the sheet points out, we have 96 separate fueling stations throughout the state. The biggest ones are Pierre, followed by Brookings, and then Sioux Falls and Rapid City. And then you have fueling stations in a lot of small communities around the state. I can remember stopping in Woonsocket to fill up at the DOT shop there. So the issue has come up and the question's been raised, why don't we have blender pumps at each one of those stations? Well, the reality is to do that, you've got the $15,000 pump cost, and then we'd also need to put in the alcohol component, and so that tank would be involved. And those numbers are pretty similar to what vendors are reporting from the program that we started this spring with the stimulus money in the retail area. And then you also have a difference in terms of philosophy. When you're a retail station and you're selling fuel to the public, you're looking to give them a choice. Some people want to have high blends ethanol, and some don't care, and some want regular in their vehicles, and so you're giving them the choice by having the blender pump. When we're dealing with a fleet, what we're trying to do is come up with the fuel that best fits our situation and have a policy across the board. So having that choice for state employees, we really don't want that, because we're going to get all kinds of things going on there. So what we've done at our four largest fueling stations is put in special tanks that are just for the blended fuels. And we have those in Pierre, Brookings, Sioux Falls, and Rapid City, because those are the largest fueling stations where we'd get the biggest bang for the buck, and we use stimulus money to do that. And as a result, our use of ethanol in various blends is going up and will continue to go up. The three Rapid, Pier, and Sioux Falls have been operational through this year. The Brookings is in the the situation where they're moving their fleet and the tanks. And it looks, the last report I had from Dean Calamine over at SDSU was that it was probably going to be the spring before the tank was actually put in over there, although the parking lot might be done. So once Brookings is back online again, we'll see a jump in the use of the ethanol. But if you looked at that blender pump cost for us to do it at 96 stations, it's about $2.4 million that would be involved in that particular endeavor. In terms of the vehicles, we have, as it says, one of the problems has been just if they can't find a state pump in their larger locations for ethanol and they need to go to a retail, the number of retail locations has gone down in the last year or so, from 75 in January of 2010 to 65 in May 2010. And on the back side, again, we talk about the retail situation versus what we're doing with the fleet. And what we wanted to do this past year, and we talked about this at the appropriations hearings this last year, is since we have the capabilities with these three tanks and those three larger communities to really regulate the amount of fuel in the blend is to do a test. And we've completed the first 6 months of that through July. And as you can see from the data, there was a 23% decrease in the miles per gallon in the E85 test vehicles versus, and we were using E85 through July 1 versus the E10. Now, since July 1st, we've gone to E30, and that was a recommendation from some folks in the ethanol industry that said, we think if you go to E30, and some actually recommended E20, but we settled on E30 as your blend, you're going to see the mileage situation really improve. And so we're in the process of doing that right now for this next 6 months, and then we'll sit back and see, okay, what were the numbers using E85 versus E30 average blend, and then, have some information that we can provide to the new administration, also to the legislature this coming year. As far as the vehicles that we have, our passenger vehicles, we have under Governor Rounds purchased whenever possible the flex fuel vehicles, so they can take the anything from regular up to E85, that number has been stagnant the last year and probably be stagnant for this next year because we didn't buy vehicles last year. Right now we don't have plans to buy any new vehicles this year just because of the budget situation that the state's in. And so we're going to stick around that same percentage of vehicles that are flex fuel. As this handout shows, there are a number of vehicles that the state uses that flex fuel option is not available. So even if we wanted to go to 100% on flex fuel at this point in time, that's not available. The real solution, and I was actually looking at some figures. I think the state's total amount of fuel that we consume is about half a percent of the total amount of fuel that's brought in and taxed in this state. So relatively speaking, the state, we don't move the gauge very much. I mean, if we were going 100% alcohol or ethanol, it still wouldn't really move that gauge. Is there an important leadership role that we take in that? Yes, and that's why we have tried to find ways to increase the use of ethanol, and we'll continue to do that. But in the scheme of things, the real answer for, and those of you involved in agriculture know this more than anything, the real answer for the use upping the use of ethanol is for the EPA to approve of E15, because you'll have a huge jump in all of these vehicles, not just this fleet, but the private vehicles that are using E15 versus E10. And until the EPA makes that decision and approves that, hopefully, we're going to be stuck at kind of at the point we're at as far as the getting some of that ethanol consumed. So we're hopeful for that. I've seen piece of correspondence that was last late winter, early spring, that said that the EPA was going to make a decision on that this summer, and they still haven't done that yet. So that's kind of frustrating. But should that happen, then we would be purchasing E15 as opposed to E10. And again, we're waiting to see what those test results are this half of the year, and then make a decision on whether we want to go to something other than E85 or E30, et cetera.
Good. Senator Thiessen has a quick question for you before you leave.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, how much extra do we pay for flex fuel vehicles?
In the beginning, and I'll let John address this because John has a very strong background in terms of fleet management. In the beginning, there was additional costs. And the last time we purchased vehicles, which was now going on 2 years, there wasn't any additional cost in purchasing those flex fuel vehicles.
Another follow-up question.
Please.
I'm wondering who's burning the 500,000 gallons of regular gasoline?
Well, what would happen would be that some agency would purchase that. Could be any one of the state agencies that have tanks. In some cases, it's going to be going into their pickup trucks where they can't use other blends, or that's the price that they got for that under the contract. They went and put out for bids on that. But I guess rather than babble about that, I'll let John talk about that and answer that question.
Do we have vehicles that can't burn anything but regular gas? We have vehicles that can't burn E10?
Could I turn that over?
Before you leave, can we hold that one for a minute? Representative Solberg has a quick question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the handout you got here, I'm having a little bit of difficulty with it, where the 23 cents per gallon cheaper for E85, but it resulted with loss of mileage to a $1.49 cost per operating increase for an E85 vehicle. Could you explain that?
Yeah, I think I'll defer to John on those figures.
Okay, we'll let you sneak out, and John can answer first Senator Thiessen's question, then Representative Solberg's question.
And if I could, Mr. Chairman, he's got another presentation to present.
Yeah, that's fine. John, if you just want to answer these questions quick, and then we'll let you dive in. Kind of trial by fire for you here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. What was the question you wanted
Senator
to
Thiessen,
know?
Senator Thiessen, would you reiterate your question, please?
The question is regarding the fact sheet shows that we burned 500,000 gallons of regular gasoline. I wonder who's burning that gasoline and why is anybody using regular?
Regular gasoline is used in some of the off-road equipment that we have that don't burn E10 very well. We have other units that are towing heavy equipment. Ethanol and 10% at the time, it does not provide enough power for some of it when they're maxing out their one-ton vehicles, pulling some of the heavy equipment and trailers that they have to use. Game fishing parks is very heavily involved in that. And some of the 450s and 550s that we're running for the one-and-a-half-ton, so to speak, vehicles that DOT has. And regular just works out better. Also, at the same time, even though ethanol is cheaper, basically overall with the state, 10% is cheaper overall with the state, there's some locations that if you look at the fueling sites and you look at where the ethanol comes from out of the seven terminals across South Dakota, every time you need fuel, ethanol 10% may not be cheaper at that moment from some specific terminal in the state. And if the agency needs fuel during that time, they're going to get the lowest, whatever's the cheapest at that time. And a lot of times they have to buy 1,000 or 1,500 gallons to fill their tanks, or 5,000 gallons to fill their tanks, and they may be using regular at that time when it is cheaper.
Just a real quick follow-up. Are state employees given directives on what fuel to use, or do state employees, are they allowed to make their own decisions regarding fueling?
We don't mandate for state employees to use a specific fuel. We recommend to them that when they're traveling to use state sites as much as possible, because we usually have the cheapest fuel and the E10 or E85 doing the testing. The people that are driving the E85 testing vehicles are told to use, if they can find it, traveling commercially. When they're away from the three sites that have it right now of Rapid City, Pier, and Sioux Falls, if they couldn't find E85 at those sites or they weren't around them, to go get 10% or find a commercial station without traveling a great deal of distance out of their way to use an E85 station from a commercial site. We do recommend that. But mandating a certain fuel, no, they have some leeway in that, because depending upon, just like with the sites that disappeared, our 85 stations that we had 75 of them when we began the test. Halfway through the test, we've got 65, and some of the people were calling us at the time when they're traveling. They pulled into some of the co-ops, and where we were notified that, yes, they have E85, and they said, no, I'm sorry, we've closed our 85, and we're now putting something else into it. We're not selling enough of it. So all of a sudden, you're out of fuel, and you have to get what they have. So at that point in time, the person has to make his decision. If they have 10%, they'll usually get it. If they have regular, they'll get it to travel on. So they have the leeway for that.
Before we go to Senator Merchant, we'll go to Representative Solberg, and you can answer his question.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I read this with interest. It says the 23 cents per gallon cheaper E85, but the mileage loss resulted in a $1.49 cost per mile increase for E85 vehicles.
I'm not aware of the $1.49 per mile increase, sir. I'd have to look into that and find out. That may be a typo, and it's 14.9 cents. I'm not sure for the specific E85 vehicles, unless that's the figure of the number of mileage of miles that we drove. We drive a tremendous amount of miles between the E85. Those vehicles drove approximately 12 million miles during that test, and a small increase could really jump up quite a bit in the overall cost per vehicle. But I would have to do some research on that, sir.
But a $1.49 a gallon, that's impossible to increase.
That's what I'm trying to figure out. I don't know. I can see possibly a decimal that was off on that one.
We'll double check on that, would you, John? Over the lunch hour, we'll find out afterwards. Senator Merchant, then Senator Ahlers.
Thank you. I really appreciate the fact that you're doing testing. That is really comforting. But I do want to go back to the use of regular, and perhaps in our bidding process, maybe we need to limit it to those applications that it requires for the use, because then I think, you know, being an ethanol-producing state, at least if we're moving toward 10% and then 15, hopefully very soon, you know, nearly as much as we possibly can, rather than start, you know, pie in the sky with the E85, yes, that's wonderful that we're looking at that, and I hope that we can apply that really soon, and it's, you know, it's cost-effective at some point. But the fact that you said that it waivers the cost of regular and E10 sounds to me like it might be a wash in the end. And why not just limit those bids to usage of those vehicles or applications that do require the regular? Can we move toward that?
I would have to defer that to Jeff Holden on the purchasing contract that they would have for that, on how that would done.
Looks like the commissioner wants to tag in.
Mr. Chairman, if I could. That would essentially take a policy change to say we're not going to take the lowest price fuel that's available and we're going to spend more money to fuel the vehicles on a given day because of the purchase of that tank. I think that's discussion's been had in the past few years, at least the last 4 years, and the decision's been made looking just at the budget situation that, you know, on a given day, if we can get a fuel that will work for our vehicles that's the cheapest for that day, that would be the fuel that we would be purchasing as opposed to paying an additional cost. Could it be done? Yes. It would take what you would do is when you were speccing out the purchase, you would say must be E10. We won't be buying regular. We're buying the lowest priced E10 for that day. So as of right now, the policy has been, and I think because of the budget situation, the policy would be we need to get the lowest fuel that we can get that will run our vehicles under the open market situation.
Yeah, I guess if I could just throw a comment in. Well, I guess I can because I'm the chair. I do see if you break down just the gasoline and not the diesel, we're looks like in 10 we purchased 2.6 million gallons of fuel, not including diesel. Of that 2.6 million gallons, over 2 million of that was, 2.1 million of that was some blend of ethanol. So the 50% is a little deceiving because the 50% only says it's 50% of all fuel that we purchased. If you take out the almost 1.5 million gallons of diesel, that number with my rough math is going to be somewhere over 75, probably 80% of all fuel we purchased is an ethanol blended fuel. So, Senator Merchant, follow up again.
What I'm hearing from you, though, is that on a daily basis, this really wavers anyway. So in the long run, perhaps the costs even out. Are we limiting vendors? Are we keeping people from bidding? I guess that would be a concern. But these companies sell both types of fuels, and there's competition within the E10, right? There's not just one, you know. So we still have open competition. You know, I guess I'd like to see a comparison at some point in time. You know, maybe you've been tracking it and you know that internally already. I just throw it out as a concept that perhaps since we create ethanol here, we want to use as much as we possibly can within reason for cost.
Hey, thank you. Senator Allers. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you did. Okay. Well, Representative Putnam.
Help too, and they may be covering this when John comes up to give his presentation. Not all of the fleet has license plates on them. There are sweepers, there are all kinds of lawnmowers, there are on and on and on that require the old type. They haven't been updated yet. God bless, we don't have to spend those dollars, but we've got some older equipment out there that we still use in the contracting business that still use the regular gasoline. That's one of them. Although there may be a few in his presentation, maybe there's a number that will appear that show non-licensed vehicles that are gasoline-powered. And there's a lot of them out there, I can tell you. And that's what happens under the construction business as well as the roads and grounds and buildings here. All those are gas-powered yet. They haven't been updated. That's why some of that amount is a large number. Thank you.
Thank you. Good point. And Senator Thiessen?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Before we leave this subject, I just want to make it clear that I don't have any objection to any of the presentation here or the fuels that are being used in the analysis that's been done, except that I'm concerned that it appears that individual state employees get to make a determination when they pull up to the pump what kind of fuel they put in the vehicle. And I think if we have a fuel management program, that we ought to have management determining that this category of vehicles, these state trooper cars, operate on E10. This big pickup is eligible to use regular gasoline for whatever reason, and that ought to be either put on the vehicle or stipulated to the employee. I think if we allow employees to pull up and decide what kind of gas they want to put in the vehicle, that you don't have a very effective fuel management program. Thank you.
Commissioner?
If I could just respond. The only situation where that would happen, where they actually have the choice, is where they're going to a commercial retail site versus to one of those 96 state fuel sites. Because when they go to those fuel sites, we've already purchased the fuel. They don't have any choice. They're going to pump. If it happens to be regular because that was the lowest price, that's what they're going to pump. If it happens to be E10, which is most of the time, that's what they're going to pump. If it's one of those flex fuel vehicles at the three big sites, soon to be four, then they'll be getting the E85 or E30 or whatever blend we end up with a year from now. It's only in the retail sites where they're going to go, and we're not there. We could tell them to do that too, by the way, and if they decided to pump it else, we'd have really no way of knowing. Or would your EJ Ward know that?
The fueling card, the Voyager card is what they would use.
Okay.
At the commercial sites. And the Voyager card, we could track if we knew the vehicle. We'd have to run a daily report on every vehicle we have, and that's 3,500 vehicles out there, which is quite a considerable report. To say exactly what they in that car at that time. Most of the time, our state employees will use 10% when they can with all standard vehicles because it's the lowest price at the pump. That's what we ask them to use, the lowest price at the pump. When you go in, 10% or the plus vehicle gas. Yeah.
John, if you would pull the mic over so make sure get you on the internet.
When you pull up to the pumps, the commercial pumps, usually the plus or the cheapest fuel is the 10% added, and it's standard. And most people use that at all times. The only times you're going to have a problem is when you pull up to a station, and we've had this happen. It's very rare to where some of the tanks are empty because they're waiting fuel loads, and all of a sudden they've got one and diesel. So you have to use the regular pump that they have. Sometimes they've had to use premium. Usually they'll tell us, and because we question that when it comes in on the report from Voyager credit cards. So we can track that, but it would be awful time-consuming and expensive to have them run daily reports for us. We have monthly reports come from them showing total uses of fuel, and we have exceptions in that. And when we have the exceptions, we'll look at them and find out, because I can go and pull up a single car and say, over this period of time, please give me the data of what fuels were put in that car. And that's how we're verifying our E85 test vehicles at the same time right now, because at the end of each month, we run the report to make sure, okay, how much E85 are they actually using against the others. We check that at the EJ Ward state fueling sites. We run the reports, and also from the Voyager credit cards, we run the reports on those vehicles and the tests specifically. And it tells us that right now, the ones when we were doing the E85 tests from the state, we're using basically 99% of the time they used. A 98-99 was standard. We had a few of them that had on 100% of the time they filled with E85. We did find some that with the regular fueling, before they got the message, actually a couple of percentages used E85 when they shouldn't have been. So we just had to make sure of that so we didn't skew our data from the end test. But we can track that.
Good. Senator Haverly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I might differ with you on the fact that ethanol products are cheaper, at least at the commercial, than regular unleaded. I mean, it varies. Out West River, it varies. For a good many years after ethanol production came to be more of a player, we were usually anywhere from 5 to 10 cents a gallon cheaper on the unleaded product, so versus the 10% ethanol. And now it varies with time, and it varies with, like right now, I think they're running probably within a 1 to 2% difference.
I know last night I came back from Lead and when I was out there and I filled up in lead, and I was surprised that the 10% blend was cheaper.
It is cheaper right now. Yeah, there's no there, so it fluctuates. But you know, anyway, the amount you made mention of it in your last statement, and I'll try and turn this into a question. I think there's a little bit of confusion. I don't think I'm confused, but it sounds like there's some confusion as to the 96 sites that are available for state employees. The only other time that they're going to purchase is when they pull into a gas station.
Correct.
And there's no other available source. And then you have to leave that at the discretion of the employee somewhat. You can look at the card, and you can see what they charged, and you can say, boy, they bought 10% or they bought regular or whatever. But in order for you to know what the cheapest price was, you would actually have to call that commercial gas station.
That's true.
I mean, am I correct in that assumption?
You're correct, yes.
Okay, so if you start to multiply the amount of times, and I don't know what they are, you know, obviously Representative Putnam made a very good point. I mean, we have a lot of vehicles out there, whether they're the grass cutters and everything else that are still out there doing the regular. You're going to have to put a little bit of faith in your employees to say that they're doing the right thing.
Correct.
I think if you start to mandate, you're going to run into just the opposite problem. I mean, you can correct me if I'm wrong, of purchasing not the best product for the car at that particular time, whatever the cheapest may be. And if the vehicle's available to run on regular or 10% or E85 or whatever, I would hope that you have a little bit of faith in your employees to take that and use that as discretion. But am I correct in the fact that it would take a lot of manpower to be checking every gas station that, I mean, I don't know how many people use commercial pumps.
Well, we have approximately 25% of the fuel, probably 500,000 gallons or so from the commercial card side is used over a period of a year. Various fuels, whether it's diesel or whether it's 10% or E85. Voyager is we depend quite a bit on Voyager card.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
We have to. When you travel out of state, we don't have them. A lot of people are traveling out of state. A lot of our sites, the universities have sites. The major Regents universities have sites to fill up, and our employees know it. DOT sites are available. Game Fish and Park sites, some of the big sites are very available, but others are back off in the woods, and it's just like going up to West Bend on 34. You're not going to drive 9 miles off the road unless you really need fuel so real quick to get down in there to find that gate, and at that time you don't know whether it's open or closed, so you can get into the sites. So a lot of the sites only have 500-gallon tanks, so they run out. We've got a couple of sites in Yankton. Vermilion. We have two tanks down there, and they handle 1,000 gallons each. Well, a lot of people come through that area, Highway Patrol included and all, and use them up, and we fill them up once a week. So you don't know what you're going to get until that weekly report comes out. Hopefully we'll get 10% in there at least.
Now, in a follow-up to the 96 sites, do you... Unless you have a lot more power and influence with the fuel industry in the world than what I believe you have, they don't come to you offering you a great deal. You have to go out and acquire the best deal that's available out there. And then when you purchase that fuel, when you purchase those barrels or whatever, I don't know what they – I know I'm a little familiar with how gas stations do it, but, I mean, you actually – You are purchasing the best deal of the time, and you can do that into the future. Is that?
Well, that would be up to each individual agency that owns the tanks to buy the fuel. Game Fish and Parks purchases their fuel off the state contract. Regents purchases their fuel. Fleet and Travel Management, we lease vehicles to all the state agencies. We manage them for them. We charge a mileage rate. The mileage rate includes fuel. We get all of this report back in, and we pay for everybody, Game Fish and Parks, or whoever we got fuel from during that month. They send us a bill at the end of the month saying, this is how much we bought, this is how much your vehicle's used. Now, they have their own equipment, which we don't manage, and I don't know. We were talking about the pieces of equipment, the off-road and construction equipment, lawnmowers, all that. I have no idea how much of that fuel is used for them because we don't track that. We don't manage the equipment itself. That's a department function. So they have their keys to the pumps. They run it through. They pump their fuel into their lawnmowers and everything else. But we don't know what they're using. They may use regular out of one tank, and they may use 10% out of another one. But I don't know how much of that fuel goes into off-road equipment that we don't. I guess the easiest way to say it is we manage one-ton and below vehicles with license plates. Anything licensed, we should manage. So if it doesn't have a license plate on it, some of these little gem cars that are out now, these little hybrids, they're running around the farms and local campuses, but they're never on the highway. So without that, we don't know what's taking place with those units or how much fuel is being used in that respect.
Right. Okay. John, we're about 5 minutes from when you're supposed to be done. Just let me, don't move, just let me ask, is there anyone here that is wanting to give public testimony on this agency review? Is there anyone in the audience? If you are, raise your hand. I don't believe there is, but... Okay. I just want to be fair to the people that came to testify at 10:45 and we're not there. So why don't you go ahead and start your presentation now, and we will then adjourn no later than 11:15 to do our tour, come back and continue after that if necessary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks, John. Go ahead.
Fleet and Travel Management, the mission of Fleet and Travel Management is to provide the most reliable, dependable, and safest vehicles we can for our employees around the state. Any of the 14,000 employees we have can use a vehicle, and we want them to be safe and have a reliable equipment, and also the most fiscally responsive vehicles to our employees. We have approximately 3,500 vehicles at any one time that we're managing across the state. Last fiscal year, the state traveled a little over 37 million miles with those vehicles. That's a lot of miles. Our average trip from the pool, when you pick up a pool car out of pier and go on a trip, it's basically 537 miles. If you're going someplace, it's going to be away from pier and coming back. It's a long way. So we have quite a few vehicles that tally a lot of miles. We work with agencies, all the agencies in the state, for giving them vehicle assistance and specifications for the vehicles they need. The right vehicle for the job is what we try to get. Game Fishing Park is a good example of that. When I first got here, there was no specific vehicles that they were using. They were just buying whatever they wanted. A pickup truck was a pickup truck to them. We started some standardization procedures and went through them and found out that we could standardize on basically a half-ton extended cab pickup, full-size pickup for most of the conservation officers throughout the state, which worked very well. And doing that, we got a better buy from the manufacturers, the OEMs, on the type vehicle that we wanted, because we would say, okay, it had these specific standards for it, and we were basically saving about $700 a vehicle off our cost just for standardizing on that one vehicle. Instead of one vehicle costing us $22,000 for a 4x4 pickup, it was costing us $21,000, and it was quite a savings, and it fit the need and seemed to last longer. One of the problems we have is trying to keep all the employees happy in what they use. Not necessarily because they want the biggest and brightest and newest cars, but they want a dependable car. They want something that's economical to run because their bureaus or their departments are paying for it, and they're getting the pressure for travel. We order vehicles. We assist in ordering vehicles for other agencies. We do the registrations. We do life cycle costing for the maintenance, and we work with the property management on the disposal of our vehicles. Right now, we're disposing vehicles basically at 65 months to 75 months, 106 to 110,000 miles, and we're getting a good residual on them, knowing that we have to sell them to the public, and we have six auctions for public auction, two in the springtime and four across the state this fall coming up next month, and works very well for us. We handle all the PM scheduling, repairs, accidents, recalls. Everything is included that we track and pay for all the agencies on the vehicles. All of this is included in a cost per mile rate for the type of vehicle that they're using. We have an automated fuel management system for fuel tracking, as we've been talking about. It's provided by a company called EJ Ward. It's the second system we've had since I have been here. It works very well. We can track all the mileage for all the vehicles through a key. When they put it in, they put the mileage into the pump, and they can dispense the fuel that they require. If we have vehicles with this system that we want to run off E10 or whatever is in there that we buy, we have coded the key that they can't use it on a diesel pump. It also saves up some problems because the key will not be allowed to turn on the diesel pump. It'll only turn on the pump for that particular car. To a point where if we get to an E85 history or an E30 blend that we want to use, we can put it in the E85 pumps and we can configure the key and through the computer to use only that pump. If they go into it and where somebody at one station or one state site had two tanks and one had regular for their off-road equipment and one had the other one had a 30% blend in it, they wouldn't turn on the off-road equipment tank. It would only turn on the 30% blend and they could get the fuel at the state sites. We manage the Voyager credit card system, as we've been talking about. So all the cars have the credit cards with them in case they can't find a state site or they're traveling out of state at that time to use. Direct access. Myself and my staff have direct access to OEMs, the original equipment manufacturers' representatives. We have right now dealings with Chrysler, Ford, and GM reps. We can talk to them by picking up the phone or emailing them at any time. We have a good representatives on all of them that have worked with us over the years, providing us with information and assistance if we have problems with the vehicles, whether it's a recall or whether it's just something that we're coming up with, that we have a recurring problem we can't correct, and we're working on some of those right now with some of the manufacturers, and we have direct access to them, which helps us a lot in managing the fleet. I belong to NAFA, which is the National Association of Fleet Administrators, which is basically about an organization 75 years old. It has 6,500 members. 3,500 of those are fleet managers across Canada and the United States. The others are basically suppliers of parts for vehicles that we can contact and talk to. We have legislators that lobby for us in Congress through NAFA. We have all the updates that we get from Congress on changes, whether it's the EPA or DOT laws that come out. We're kept updated on those at every time. At all times they change. We're one of the few states that's consolidated. When Governor Janklow back in 96-97 consolidated the fleet, I don't know how many other fleets were consolidated at that time, but right now there are about three states that have a consolidated fleet, and most of those have done so in the last 5 years. I'm contacted many times by states, Colorado, Montana, Georgia, Virginia, that are undergoing some testing right now and looking into consolidation. They're asking me questions about it. I've taught classes on it at the NAFA Institute that we have every year. So it is something that is coming around. We are a little ahead of the curve on that, to where
you can find out, and people are finding out, you run a consolidated fleet, you can run it a lot cheaper. When I first got into this and started talking to other states when I came out here, people were telling me that they were running their cars for basically 20 cents a mile. And I couldn't figure out how they could do it because we were running out here as lean as we could just about, and we were running at 30 cents a mile. Then I came to figure out, and talking with them and getting their stats, they were not what we call a fully loaded fleet. A fully loaded fleet is all cost involved in it, including overhead and all the maintenance, accidents, repairs, fuel, depreciation, everything. The only thing they were considering with their running their fleet at 20 cents was maintenance, repair, and fuel. So there's a great big difference. Right now, our fleets are running total overall cost. The last 6 months on the report I ran last month was 38.6 cents a mile. And that's the average cost for 3,500 vehicles running this fleet state. And it's basically 19 million miles that was run in the last 6 months. It'll slow down during the wintertime. There's a lot of vehicles out there that have extreme high mileage now, and it's something we work at. We lose right now basically about one car per day due to old age, mechanical failure, wear and tear that needs to be replaced, accidents. Now, we work closely with risk management. And the accidents car to car, you'd have probably about 100, and it's not anything major. We don't have major accidents, but we track other type accidents that cost us. Since we can't file claims against the deer and the pheasant that go through the radiators and the grills, and right now if you go through, a pheasant goes through a grill and a radiator, you're talking $1,000 plus labor real quick. That's an accident to us that we have to cover. Same thing with windshields. They'll take out a windshield that's a $600 windshield. Cars aren't cheap anymore.
You can file a claim, John. The payback rate is pretty low, though.
Payback rate is very low. I don't want to say anything out, but we had an incident I thought was that woke me up to the fact. We had a cow. We had one of our people hit a cow coming over the hill at night that was in the road. Did quite a bit of damage to the car. He was a DCI agent. Did quite a little bit of damage to the car and everything else. And we came in, and he reported it to the Highway Patrol, and we filed all the paperwork and sent it to risk management just to let them know what had taken place, because they get all the accident reports that were involved like that. And they sent it back. I got it back from risk management. This was during the Judy Payne era. I didn't want to say anything while Dennis was looking at me. But and it came back saying, we need more data with any witnesses to this. And we laughed and turned it over to the Highway Patrol, one of the officers out at the Highway Patrol, and he said he would investigate it. And he came back and he said that he'd investigated it, and he talked to three cows, and no witness would respond. And that was it. So we don't get anything for that. But we have a lot of accidents that cost us through animals. A lot of deer. We'll have 100 deer a year hit that just can't be helped. Turkeys.
Oh, Representative Putnam.
Yes, sir.
How do you follow that up, Representative Putnam?
I are too old to be on a lot of these committees because we remember the doggone much stuff in the old days. But, you know, there's an old cowboy saying that says, you can brag without lying, go ahead and brag. And John's doing a good job of bragging because he's not lying. And I happen to have chaired that committee for the Jankel administration to reform planes, trains, and autos, as what Jankel called it. And I can just tell you, and I'm sure John will get to it eventually, but in place, to put in place, for example, there just wasn't any way that we could handle the fleets that we had in this great state. And in many times, a citizen would drive by the Holiday Inn in a city, and there would be four cars there, and there would only be one driver per car going to the same meeting at the same place at the same time. This reform that John's working on helped put in place a system, I think it's called the Journey System. He'll talk about that. And the other one was, there were just a few people in the state that could speed out there without having some situation occur to them some years ago. So when a state car went by a citizen out there at 85 mile an hour and it didn't have anything on it except it said state, the Janklow administration said from now on every car for every agency will have the plate on it that says where they're from. And so if there are any complaints, the settlement will get them, and they will have a number on them that says social services or city or county. And so all of those reforms were well done. And because of that, other states are calling and asking, how in the world is this done? Because they are spending a ton of money out there trying to manage those fleets. So a little feather for you, John. Those were darn good days, and they finally have resulted in some savings for us all up here.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much.
Thank you. No, appreciate that. Please continue, John.
Okay. The consolidation of the data was one of the main things that was really needed from all the fleets in the state. And when you've got 20 to 40 different fleets for the departments and individuals running them, you really didn't have any overall picture of what was taking place with the vehicles and the actual cost. Now, with the consolidated vehicle data located in one department, our Department of Fleet and Travel, we can give you the cost per vehicle, cost per mile, and cost per department at any time through our reports on a daily basis. We know the work order history of any vehicle that we have in the fleet, and we have about 20,000 work orders per year, per fiscal year, that are put out. Most of the work orders are actually for what we call preventative maintenance, PM maintenance. We work a different system for PM maintenance that has worked better for us. Most of the cars, if you're driving a new car now, your maintenance manual say probably about every 7,500 miles you should change the oil. Originally, it used to be every 3,000 miles, let's change the oil, and the vehicle will continue to run. Due to the weather conditions out here with the extreme colds, temperatures, the dust we work in and the construction work that's done and the off-road driving we have on dirt and gravel roads, Fleet and Travel has determined it's basically 4,000 to 4,500 miles. We should do the oil changes and PMs for the vehicles, for the brake wear and everything else that's checked in the fluid levels. And it seems to work out very well for us. That means basically we're talking about 25 work orders per vehicle per year for just maintenance and or PM oil changes and checking over the vehicles. This works very well for us. We track all the costs. The maintenance for the vehicles, any accident repairs included in our maintenance cost, anything that we do to change tires, tire wear, everything else when we put them on is included in our maintenance cost per mile. We have the overhead, which is our rental areas that we have for our cost. We rent and lease buildings from DOT and some of their older sites, and we have our wash bay as a DOT building that we lease from them. All of that, salaries, everything else is included in that overhead. Depreciation of all the vehicles that we buy, and basically the fuel. And the fuel cost for each vehicle per mile that we have that. Vehicle mileage, department mileage, month. Quarter, fiscal year, all of that is maintained by us on a daily basis. We supply travel programs, as one of them is the Journey system, where right now anybody in the state that's a state employee can have their travel coordinator go online for their department and reserve them a car in one of our 22 sites across the state. We have them at airports for people to fly in and use. We have them. The three major pool systems that we have are Pier. We have about 90 cars in Pier and Brookings at the university there, which is people were calling the Brookings or SDSU motor pool. It's actually a Fleet and Travel motor pool on their site. We have approximately 120 cars there. And as far as Vermilion at USD, outside of USD campus, we have 75 vehicles at
Senator Haverly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are there is there vehicles at School of Mines campus like that in that pool?
Yes, they are. We have approximately 25 or 30 vehicles at School of Mines that the campus can use.
I've scratched my head. I drive through there very frequently.
On the backside by the
parking
football
lot, and I wonder why those vehicles are sitting there all the time. And
they're traveling quite a bit. They have about 25 to 30 vehicles on campus out there that people check out to use, and they're gone most of the summer with their paleontology and everything else and all their other work from Utah to Colorado and Washington State. So they're very well used.
Representative Feigert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Curiosity in all of this, the 3,500 vehicles, does that include the tandem trucks that are in the highway regional offices and that, and the fuel, the diesel fuel, is that reflected that those vehicles burn in these numbers?
No, sir. The diesel fuel is reflected in there because they use keys for DOT diesel vehicles. They have fueling keys. We do not manage those vehicles. DOT heavy equipment and is not managed by us. They manage their own equipment as far as the heavy tandem trucks and the road work and road trucks. But, yes, that diesel fuel is accounted for in those figures.
Please.
Do you have any idea what number of semi-tractors, tandem trucks, single-axle trucks, where do we get those numbers?
I get them from DOT because I have to give them for a insurance reason to risk management every year. And right now, my understanding is there's 791 pieces of heavy equipment that DOT has.
Okay, please.
What determines, you had talked earlier about one-ton vehicles. Is there a split, or where is the break where your department is responsible?
Basically, well, if you're familiar with equipment, you know that a 550 is not really a one-ton. It's a one-and-a-half-ton. It's called, some people call it a two-ton, depending on what it's doing. I would say a 550 is the split. Everything down, if DOT has a 550 and they don't have it configured for as a dump truck, basically, and it carries passengers or crew work, they have got us managing it. They're not that many pieces of that heavy. Most of the stuff that we have is one ton, 3,500s or 350s below.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Haverly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned the diesel fuel and then triggered another question. Do you contract with any commercial gas stations for state employees? None.
The journey system, like I say, can be used for short-term leases. If somebody needs something for 2 weeks or less, or going on a trip or whatever, they can go on the journey system and pick a pool car up from one of our pool sites. If they need it for longer than that, we have forms on the web on our BOA website under Fleet and Travel where they can request an assigned vehicle. We have 456 pool vehicles located across the state at various locations. The rest of the vehicles, basically 3,000 of them, are assigned to departments and agencies that need vehicles on a daily basis. DSS needs quite a few of them. Department of Labor uses them for different things. So every agency has certain numbers of assigned vehicles, and they have coordinators or contacts for us at that agency for those vehicles. We have names and addresses for them and phone numbers to where we will send all the paperwork for these vehicles when they need PMs or whatever, and they will dispense them across the areas that they have their vehicles. So we're looking at that. We do assign a lot of vehicles. We're very particular on how we assign vehicles because you're not – that. I guess better explaining it, you don't want to assign a new vehicle to an agency that's only going to use it basically 100 miles a month or more around campus or whatever, and that's why we have rotational vehicles that we use. If we buy a new vehicle, I can get four times the use out of it, basically. If I buy 200 new vehicles a year, I can replace basically 600 to 700 of those vehicles by rotating them. I put them in the pool the first 2 years that they're new. I take the one-year-old or two-year-old cars out of the pool that I've replaced and put them out into high mileage areas. And when I mean high mileage areas, these people are driving 18,000 miles a year at least. I put them out. I take their car that may have 100,000 miles on it that needs to be replaced, and I will put it into a use either at an airport or a college campus or something where I know that I'm going to get another 3 years worth of use out of it, and they're only driving it 400 to 500 miles a month. And they've got a good mechanically sound car. So we rotate through as we go. And depending on what we need in an emergency use, we buy vehicles from federal property. And when you heard from federal property last month, we're one of the biggest buyers from federal property. They treat me very well. They notify me when they have new vehicles. They notify me when they're going out to buy something in case I need something specific I can ask them to look for. I've even been out with them on a couple of jaunts to see how they work and how they do it. And it's quite amazing. And we get some good vehicles. They're very good at looking at equipment and seeing. For an example, a few years back, we were buying 2004 Breezes. And we bought 40 or 50 of them real quick. Some of them had 3,000 miles on. They were 3 years old. Others had 22,000 miles. The feds bought them. They didn't use them. We bought them extremely cheap. I drove them for anywhere up to 100,000 miles. Some of them are still on the fleet right now, and they're not costing us much at all to drive. And we made quite a good buy off of them, and that was because a lot of help was from federal property. Because they went out and inspected them and bought what we needed, and were very safe. So we have all of that ability to work and end up with a good fleet. We also have and manage at the women's prison two offices out there. They're managed by one of our travel coordinators and claims clerks. Inmates sit at a desk and maintain a phone and phone contact and emergency number service 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. We have assisted our drivers across the state in years past by helping them with need of fire trucks, police, wreckers, whatever has been needed because they've been broken down or had an accident, they need a new vehicle, they can dial that 800 number and somebody will answer. These seem to be very reliable people we've trained and worked with. We try to keep them as long as we can. A lot of them are in there for quite a while. Others, they move out quickly for training or their pardon or parole. So it's a staff that we rely on heavily as a 24-hour-a-day emergency number and monitor the people. They also, in one of the rooms, do a lot of our data entry as far as the vouchers that we have coming in, and they put the data in, and they maintain files out there for us, locked up in two of the rooms for all the records of the vehicles that we maintain. We also provide a driver's handbook and information booklet that has all the policies and procedures for fleet and travel. It shows them where to get vehicles. It has the numbers to call, how to get vehicles, what to do with during an accident, where the sites for fueling are located, and all the other information about proper use of a state vehicle. Who can ride in a state vehicle, who can drive a state vehicle, and how to get repair work orders. Whatever's needed is in that manual. That is updated from time to time when we have major changes. We have to print about 5,000 of those to put out each year to give to departments or when we send them out, plus some all new ones in the vehicles. The journey system, we provide training on the journey system. Any agency that has a travel coordinator that's been changed or somebody that leaves, they need training. We'll send our people out to train the new coordinator on how to use the journey system and who we are and how to contact people. We've had a lot of people that have never met a fleet and travel person before in face-to-face out in across the state. We now have customer service personnel that is part of their duties, and they run around the state and they talk to vendors. They talk to schools. They talk to agencies all across the state face-to-face. And we work out any kind of problems we have or what their needs are, and try to answer any questions that they have. We try to update as much as we can and keep people informed as much as we can on what's needed and what we have available for them. And we have a lot of specialty orders at times that we go out for with the Governor's Hunt, Buffalo Roundup, and such things as that, where events are put on and we provide vehicles for them. We try to keep them as safe as possible as far as all the recalls or anything else that's done. We maintain them as best we can. We're getting great use out of them and running them probably as cheap as any other state or consolidated fleet in the country. That's private or government. And I know that, and I'd put it up against us against anybody right now because I hear it when I go to the meetings and I hear it on the web when we're talking and emailing back. The state of South Dakota is, we're one of the few states that have two certified fleet managers. I'm one of them, and we have a certified fleet manager at Brookings, my deputy director that is up there, David Strom, who is also on the Board of Governors for NAFA, and has been a member, and we hired him away from Iowa State University, where he was fleet manager for several years, about 11, and got him back home. He's a SDSU graduate from I think it's Clark or something up there, one of the little towns near there. So he's back home. But we know what we're doing, and we try to do it the best we can, and we'll continue, hopefully.
Excellent. Well, thank you, John. Any questions? Any other questions? Representative Wismer.
You may not be the person I should ask, and if you're not, we'll just figure out who is. But this last session, there was the bill that was going to allow state employees to use their own vehicles a little bit more rather than driving 1,600 miles
yes,
to
ma'am.
Find a state vehicle. Could you review what the problems that bill failed, and I'm curious about what all the complications there are. I'm assuming it's got to be a liability thing, so maybe it's not
you. I'm not real certain exactly why. I know I still am in the loop to where I have to approve before they can get use their private vehicles for certain instances. They have to email me with a reason why and what dates they have to use this car. We still have people that are using their own cars, but they're state employees that are hired, and most of them are nurses right now that I see. I get a lot of call from the nurses out of SDSU because they have clinical trials and testing that are their nurses out of Minnesota and Iowa and all areas that don't have access to state pool cars that have to go on the daily business, and the university pays them to use their own car. Now, my understanding is that their liability insurance is primary, if I'm not mistaken, if they get in an accident. Their liability insurance would be primary on that, and then you'd have to talk to Dennis on how that would work on anything else on that.
Is it which way is cheaper as far as the state's concerned?
As far as the state's concerned, well, if in all honesty, right now, I think it's 36 cents a mile for high mileage. I can rent them a car if they can get there for 32 cents a mile. So actually,
pretty close call.
It's a pretty close call. The main problem we had, and Minnesota brought it to our attention when they gave one of our employees a ticket, a $50 ticket for driving a state car. It was parked at his house. He lived in Minnesota. I didn't know what was going on. We stopped it real quick. But you can't have an out-of-state car residence with out-of-state tag and registration from another state at your house in Minnesota and leave it there as your car because you're not paying any Minnesota taxes or anything else on it. And it came back where he got a ticket, and we found out it was being done several places, North Dakota, Nebraska. People were taking cars home with them from the universities because they were being paid private, you know, to drive the vehicle. Well, they're a Minnesota employee, a resident, but they can't take the car there and keep it. So that stopped real quick.
Okay. Good. Anything else for John before he steps away? Well, thank you, John. Appreciate the presentation. Commissioner is going to come back up. I think the commissioner and I visited briefly in the hall. Being no objection from the committee, I think we're going to change the agenda slightly. We'll let the commissioner move on and address committee discussion and directives. And at noon, regardless, we'll break for lunch. From noon to 1, we'll break for lunch. I think what's still up in the air is if we're going to go to the tour site at 1, or if we come back here, finish, and then go to the tour site and just disperse after the tour is done to go home or wherever we're going afterwards. So maybe we can leave that up to the commissioner. What would work better for the fleet folks and the record folks?
It would make no difference to them.
Okay. So we're not going to screw up their day if we go at 1 or 2:30?
No.
What does the committee wish? Would it be easier if we came back here after lunch, dispersed from here, went to our tour, and then we just went home from there? Everyone seeing some nods? Dave, how long do you think you're going to take? So 7-8 minutes, we should be done. Okay. Senator, I'm. If we came back here at 1, I would venture to guess we'd be done by. Maybe we'll plan on being on the tour by 2. I would think. I'd think an hour would about. There's no public testimony, and I don't see anyone. There was not a stampede up the stairway, so I don't suspect. They all went to the other one, yes. I don't think there'll be any public testimony. If we get through David, we'll give David an hour, and that should probably cover everything he has. And let's plan on the tour at 2 then, go from there. Representative Solberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're going to get some of the answers that we asked on that 149-cent cost per mile.
I think that's what the commissioner's doing right now.
Okay.
So, okay, hearing anything further, well, that's our plan. Commissioner, go ahead.
I'm trying to track that down, actually, on that particular issue. What I'd like to do is go back to the questions that you all had from the last meeting, and we handed out some documents in your folder. And if I could ask Mr. Nealis to come up here, and we can kind of tag team these items, and we'll just go in the order that they're in your file.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Commissioner.
And we'll just take them in the order in which you're in your file. The first one, and we just took these cut and pasted right out of the minutes from the last meeting, was the red heading. You asked that the BOA provide the committee with a more detailed listing of the BOA's other funds, and I'll let Jim address that.
Okay. Thank you.
What I've provided here is we went out and inquired into the way agencies paid those bills in that given year, and it shows you the general, federal, and other contributions through the various billing systems that we these are our major billing systems in BOA.
Okay.
So you can get an idea of the split in each one. You see it varies some between different billings. They all stand on their own. And so that answers the question of how people pay their bills.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The second part of the question was a request for a little more information on on the way rates are set. And we had had a discussion about buildings and grounds, the space billing. And so what I provided here was just these are working papers, by the way, and they're not part of financial statements or anything like that. They're just the things that we use to work with them. The first thing is it's a little chart that shows it's essentially our plan for the way we track costs and the way we deposit revenues for this. And you'll notice then if you go from that page, so that's the person that pays the bills. We sit down with him, say when it's an administrative cost, we wanted you to code it to this particular line of coding. And so then that's how that information gets built for me to see what's going on in there. I then take that information from the previous year. Accounting is kind of a backward-looking business. I take the information from the previous year, use that as a base, and then get whatever information I can glean off of the managers as to what's going to happen in the next year. And the second piece of that is this spreadsheet, this working spreadsheet. And that's just the one that we use. It's all cash basis. It's just the one that we use to estimate what the rate will be for the next year. But then as that year progresses, we're tracking in these various categories, and quarterly we then capture all the costs that occurred during that quarter and then bill it out. And at the end of the year, we know that we've told them, in this case, that we were going to bill them about $1,150 a square foot. At the end of the year, we'll see how we did against that. But those are our estimates. And we also take into account various pieces of space that are going to be offline for a given period of time because they're being renovated or whether if there are estimates that utility rates are going to go up, then we'll put into this spreadsheet that there's going to be a 10% increase in electricity, and then that becomes this estimate. But that estimate is not a contract with the agency that's what we're going to bill them. We're going to bill them whatever our costs are. But a manager then is managing towards this. This is what we told them, and we're trying to keep our costs in this range. And often we come in a little bit less.
Okay.
Than this. In my tenure here, I don't remember ever having to bill higher than what we had estimated the costs were.
Good.
And that goes on in all of the programs in BOA. It's the same way. We're tracking costs. We build this spending and revenue plan for how we're going to denote what it's for, and then we have bill payers in each one of the divisions, and then that person is very close to the manager who knows what each thing was for, and they're keeping track of all this stuff. And that way, then, I extend my ability to look into these agencies because I've got a lot of these with all the bureaus that I'm trying to keep track of.
Okay, good. All right, excellent. Okay, go ahead and continue.
The second item was a question that was asked regarding the total number of square footage that we'd been leasing versus 5 years, or I think that 5 years ago, and the answer for that is found on that kind of gold tab there. You can see we've got a reduction of, since 2005, of about 57,000 square feet, two leases, and about, you know, $500,000 to $600,000 in lease statewide. That would not just be Pier. The next question was regarding the profits for items sold through federal surplus property, and Jim prepared that one. I'll let him address it.
Okay.
Sure. I think that was Senator Haverly had asked that question. It's federal surplus property fund. That's pretty. I just didn't know what it was like on the system, so that's why I didn't give it. 6511 is the company. That's the fund on our accounting system. And I went through, on June 30th, 2010, the cash balance was $394,876. But to get that into perspective, I put the two other numbers on there. The operating costs, in other words, the administrative costs for that operation is $678,000. And they went through the purchase for resale of over $3 million of items, stuff, whatever you want to refer to it. And And that's all done with the money that's in that fund. So we're constantly turning over. So we start the year, in this case, we'll start this year, right now, with $394,000. And we also have inventory on hand that we've purchased from before. But, I mean, we're going to be selling that to individuals. That money's going to be coming back in. They're going to be going back out and ordering that money. This fund has to stand on its own. It participates in the cash pool for the state and receives interest for its cash balance. If it goes negative, as do all the funds in BOA, it has to pay interest to that fund.
Senator Haverly, I think, has a question.
Thank you, and I appreciate the answer in this form. The interest that the fund accumulates then obviously goes to the general fund, is that correct?
No, the interest goes to this fund.
So it stays with the fund?
Yes. It stays with the fund.
Okay.
In this case, it just goes to their bottom line. I mean, you know, it's part of the part of the revenue that comes into the fund.
Do you have a further question?
Because it's a participating fund, it's allowed to do that.
Okay, and as you had stated, this thing has to survive on its own. You don't borrow against any of the equipment that's standing. I mean, when you have to go out and purchase now, you're only dealing with the $394,000. You don't transfer funds in and out of this fund in order to purchase?
That is correct. Okay. If let's say it went over $1,000 and it was $1,000 negative, it would be paying the investment pool for being negative. In other words, we do an average daily balance for the whole year, and we settle up with it. It's referred to as an interest proration at the end of the year. So we settle up for any time that it may have gone negative. That it is my goal in all these funds to never have them negative, but that's not always possible.
Good. All right. Go ahead and continue, please.
The next question was regarding special events. And the bottom line is we went back and looked, and there was no tracking, or has been no tracking, of state-provided labor employee time in terms of any of those events. So, for example, the Vietnam Memorial, where, you know, we had electricians working on that, other functions of state government, buildings and grounds in terms of waste and setting up stages and all that kind of stuff. No tracking of that. So I can tell you, having been involved in the Vietnam one, pretty a lot, that there were a lot of state employees on state time working on preparing for that event. Centennial that we just completed, there was some, because it was a Saturday and we had to basically set up some stages and garbage, that kind of thing, state time involved, but not tracked. BOP didn't or hasn't tracked those kind of events specifically. As far as costs that we paid out, Jim, check that down, and I'll let him talk about that.
Yeah, I looked into it and used the Centennial as an example, because those records are more available, and I could find no indication that BOA had paid for anything. In other words, some outside entity was paying for the, you know, flowers or whatever it was. I mean, what they were providing was support in man hours. And Bureau of Administration has a responsibility for this facility, and we view that as one of the responsibilities for any of the functions that occur here. And those functions are no different than any other function that occurs. So that's why the manpower is provided.
Good. All right. Good.
The next item was a request to get an older set of the statewide M&R projects, the unfunded list, and Christy Honeywell was able to go track down the 2001 unfunded lists, and you have that in your materials there. And unless there's any specific questions, I guess you can look those over.
Representative Wismer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I meant to pull out mine from just this last year and compare them, but I didn't get that done. are there any comments about what's the overlap? Is there any overlap from 10 years ago till now? And what's the total dollar comparison?
Mr. Chair.
Please.
Representative, I did go back and compare the list, and I didn't actually look at the difference of what we were unfunded 2001 versus 2011. But what I did find is there are some projects that have been on the list for a long time. And what they typically are those projects that would fall to the bottom of the list because there's a lower risk to human health. For instance, some window projects, some floor projects that need to be done. But basically, as I explained last time with our ranking system, the age that it's been on the list is just a very small piece. Mainly, we look at those projects that are really high risk factors to the occupants of that building, and so some of those fall down farther on the list.
Follow up?
So could you pull one spendy example and that's been on the list? And I'm curious if it's what does it mean? Well, pull one spendy example.
Okay, let's take a look at maybe page 3, possibly, on Mike Durfee State Prison. I'm trying to see. This actually, it doesn't look that spendy, but replace admin windows. You know, that's been on there a long time. What I did find is there are some overlaps on some of the projects were renamed. Some of the projects that have been on there for a long time also are very expensive to do in the first place. For instance, some mechanical system upgrades where we're talking, you know, $500,000 to $700,000 at a shot, and those tend to go lower on the list because we just don't have the funding every year to get those done.
Please.
And remind me, this list, it does not include the Board of Regents. And
it doesn't include Board of Regents except for two facilities, the School for the Blind and the School for the Deaf. But typically the college campuses have their own M&R funding.
That you and so what's your role as state engineer in regards to Board of Regents, those other Board of Regents projects?
Those projects still come through our office. If they choose to do M&R project or any other project, they have to put together a work request for us, and we will do the contract administration, the project management for those particular projects. What we are not involved is the when they do them or the status of when those M&R projects come up. They make that decision themselves.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, good. Okay, go ahead and continue, please.
Okay, the last item that was requested was from Representative Putnam.
he has another conflict here, so we could...
I'll try to be brief. Just to give everybody a background, there are a number of older buildings on the campus of the Human Services Center that haven't been used for, some of them, decades. What I got for you is materials that Human Services actually provided that details the various buildings that are vacant and essentially sitting there empty. I've gone back personally and looked at some of the different studies, and if you look at the that first part of that handout with the articles on the bill from the newspapers, people have been talking about this for literally decades about what to do with those old buildings. So there are two issues. One is there's a safety issue. Some of them have been fenced off. There's a low, about a 4-foot fence around a number of the, I think there's three of the buildings that are fenced off. Some of them have not been fenced off. You know, you've got a corrections facility there. You also have a human services hospital there in proximity to these older buildings. The bottom line is that there is some interest repeatedly from different groups that would like to renovate those buildings and continue using them. But since I've been in this job and from reading these articles, nobody has ever come up with a concrete proposal and funding for using those buildings. I just had a discussion with one of the staff from the National Historic Preservation Group. I can't forget their correct title. But, you know, the reality is, I advised her, you know, there is no state money, no program that could fund renovating those buildings. There's, I said, the outlook of starting some new program, considering the budget situation we're in, is unlikely. And so as far as the state doing something with those buildings, there just isn't the funding or the need for those buildings. There continue to be people that, you know, look at it from a standpoint of private development of some type, but nobody has ever come forward with a real plan that has real money behind it to do anything with it. And so where we're at with it is, we had talked a couple years ago about demolition of several of those buildings, but it's a big number. And in light of the budget situation, rather than taking some of that pretty precious statewide M&R money and putting it towards that demolition, we have no plans for the next year to do that because we see other needs on these other state facilities, and rather than let another state building go into disrepair and end up like the ones at Yankton, we think it's more prudent just to keep the buildings we're actually using as up to date and maintained as possible. So that's where the money will be going. We don't have any intent to tear any buildings down. And so I told this person from the National Historic Preservation Group, it's been conveyed to the folks down in Yankton that basically they got another year to try to come up with some type of a use for these buildings, you know, basically from the nonprofit or from the private sector. And I know talking to Secretary Hofer and also Mr. Nelson down at Yankton that Human Services is open to any ideas that would be compatible with their primary mission, which is the hospital and the corrections facility. And so if somebody can come forward that has funding, you know, everybody's willing to listen to that. Again, it hasn't happened to date, and they basically have another year that nothing will happen to those buildings.
I'm sorry, I know Representative Putnam needs to step out. Do you have a question?
And I thank you for giving me the time, Mr. Chairman, because I had scheduled a telephone conversation at 11:30 this morning because I knew there would be a tour, and we got changed at the last minute. But thank you for bringing it up so we could cover it. Mainly the reason was, of course, is exactly as you've explained, we do have some historical people finally getting serious about whether or not they want to do something with Dr. Mead's building, the one that he had established back in the early 1900s, with regard to the marble staircase and so forth, and whether or not that should really be part of it, the historical chapters. So appreciate the opportunity to have you bring it to a wider range of people other than appropriators. Appropriators always look at these things on a yearly basis, trying to figure out what's the most efficient way to manage them without having someone walk by and have a building fall on them, etc., and whether or not they should indeed be raised and the cost of that raising. And that's where we're having the problems each and every time. And, you know, and then, again, at the end, whether they should be raised. That's, again, part of it. So the question I brought, and this is a greater amount of information and very well done with regard to what we've had in the past. And I think that'll help most legislators that are going to have this information answer those questions when the opportunity arises. The Historical Society has written many legislators about this problem. Most of them don't have that information in front of them, and this will help solve some of the situations. And once again, we have been very patient, I guess, with tearing them down. We really have been very patient because of the value that there is in those buildings if history wants to make an archive. And after a while, there will be a period of time in which you'll have to be set and something is done, or they'll be raised, one or the other. So I don't know. I appreciate the opportunity to have some say in, you know, my questions here, but I have to be excused.
That's fine. Go ahead. Thank you, Representative. Senator Haverly, then Merchant.
I see that most of thank you, Mr. Chair. I see that most of my questions as I page through this are probably within this information somewhere, but I thought we were really close to having something when we visited on appropriations I want to say 2 years ago when we were down there as an appropriations committee. I thought we came very close. I thought there was something that was
2 years ago. Mr. Chairman, Senator, we had budgeted to tear down three of the buildings, and I think about the time you were down there is about that time frame. Then we got into the session. There was some discussion about can you hold off longer, and then just in through the budget process and looking at priorities, the decision was, okay, we will hold off on demolition. We have done the tunnels, if you remember going through those, are no longer being used. They haven't been filled in yet. If I, they're still there, but they aren't being used for utilities anymore. There are no utilities going into any of those buildings. So, you know, as far as the winter and freezing and all that stuff, that's all happening because there just isn't any heat going into those buildings. So that's been taken care of. There is some asbestos removal that needs to be done before some demolition could be take place down there. But all of that basically is on hold. Just following up from what Representative Putnam was talking about, the one building that I think there is some progress on from the preservation side is the Mead building. My understanding from talking to Corey Nelson is that, you know, that group there is has a plan to use that for historic purposes, and they're doing some fundraising efforts, and still aren't there yet, but at least there is a plan locally to try to preserve that one building, which is probably the one most people are concerned about when they go down there.
Follow up to one of your statements. Did we, in fact, appropriate money for demolition, or did you come to the legislature, or was that just within your own?
It was originally on our statewide M&R list to do that, and then after discussions with various members of the appropriation, we said, okay, we'll take that off the list and move some of the other projects up.
Okay. Senator Merchant, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did find an article concerning the group, the 15-member board that is looking at trying to save the Mead building and also using it for museum purposes and right. Perhaps tourism. I guess I don't understand why they can't apply for economic development grants from our state. I don't know why there's not a crossover here, and would, you know, and maybe you're not the right person to ask that, but you know, you had mentioned that there is no money for this purpose, but what about future funds or economic development? Because certainly it's revival and it would attract people.
I guess I would have to beg off on that question and refer that over to economic development since I don't deal with that. But.
Okay. Go ahead and continue through the packet then. Thank you.
That ends excuse me. We have one more. That's right.
Yep. People Fund.
Yeah, the People Fund. And I think Dennis covered that somewhat, but I'll let Jim just talk about that last purple item.
Sure.
Go ahead.
What we've got here, I just put together the question I think last week was there's a significant balance in this fund, and so what was it for? And so I just put together kind of a little balance sheet here that shows what's going on in the fund. And the key things are the first line. First of all, you notice that the fund is split into two separate types of liability, general and vehicle, and our actuary actually gives us a report for each one of those different types. types of liability. This particular billing is actuarially based, and so we go on what the actuary tells us we need to have, because there's some looking into the future. And as I said before, you know, accountants tend to look to the past, but she also looks into the future. And I say she because our particular actuary is female. But when she looks into it, she says that an organization the size of South Dakota needs a minimum balance of $5 million. Okay. All right? So that first line shows where we're at the end of FY09, and I use FY09 instead of 10 because we haven't been audited for 10, we haven't completed our accruals for 10, and we don't have the information from the actuary. I won't get that for this year until about November. So we'll look at 9, but it's a very similar number to the cash balance that you're seeing now. We're not quite up to our full $5 million of reserve. The second line is the accrued expected liability that she sees out there. Every time that there's a claim against the state, they sit down and put a value to that claim. And it may be 10 years before that is resolved. It may be resolved in the same year. But what she knows, she puts in there as a cost. There's also the cost of operating the program and some of the actuarial work as to what we might expect to get during the year based on our past history. So that's all in that number. And those two numbers add up to a little over $9 million, and that's basically where the $9 million comes in. For our financial reporting, there's a couple of other things in there. There's accrued leave liability. In all of the bureaus, we actually, it's an allowable cost, this accrued leave that's built up. And so we actually go out and collect it from our users and have it in that fund. And so that's just the little piece of that that's in there. And then there's some accounts payable. If you look in the second section down there, you've got the cash that was in the accounting system that you could see on a cash report. And then that money is invested with the investment council, and there's a calculation that's made of some of the value that hasn't been received yet, and that's what that $550,000 is. And that's, I don't do that. Another part of BFM and legislative audit kind of work together to accomplish that. And then there's an interest receivable thing, and we hadn't quite gotten all of our interest money on the fund. This is also a participating fund, and the interest then stays in the fund and is used to offset expenses. I mean, it's something that the feds watch very closely as to whether all this money came from users based on what the actuary said, and if in fact in that component that the actuary uses to figure out how much our future liability is, if a particular claim has been overestimated, if it's out there for $500,000 and it comes in at $250,000, then that accrual would go down that $500,000, and we only spent $250,000, so there's $250,000 extra in there. When she figures out her next year to fill up my reserve to $5 million and have everything covered, then that would be something that you would not collect that again.
That would be subtracted then from
right
next
from
year.
Our cost.
Yes,
the cost, the things that we were going to try to recover.
Yep.
And if you look back to that first sheet that I gave, you can see the people fund is the bottom row across there of those billings, and you see in that particular year we billed out $2.8 million.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. Excellent. Questions on the people fund,
Mr. Good. Chair.
Representative Wismer.
So another way to put this is that the actuary says we need $5 million on hand over and above. We have $5 million in the bank over and above what we expect to owe for claims, plus the $5 million in the bank to cover the claims.
Correct. There is a $5 million reserve.
That you don't ever really expect to, that's just there for something that the actuary might not have foreseen.
Correct.
That's all.
Okay, great. Well, I don't know who put this packet together, Commissioner, but Senator Haverly and I were just commenting how well done it is with the color coordination, and even both of us were able to figure it out. So that was, I'm thinking maybe it wasn't you that put it together personally, Commissioner, but...
She's sitting behind the pillar there.
I can see her hiding, so excellent. Thank you. That was very, very well done.
I do have one other bit of information. Please. Did check on the data, and Representative Solberg is more than correct. It's 1.49 cents per mile difference between the E85, not $1.49.
Good.
Cents.
Okay, excellent.
A follow-up
question. Please. Well, it'd be your first question, so it's not a follow-up.
Okay, thank you. I noticed you used the price 23 cents cheaper. And as I drive around Sioux Falls, it's a lot of times 50 to 80 cents cheaper. How did you come to 23 cents?
Because that's, and it, frankly, it's surprising, but that's essentially what we're getting for the bids from when we buy it splash blended for those tanks. The price differential, and Jeff actually could get you the raw data on when we've gone out for bid on that, the price differential is not that great, not that much lower for the E85 when we put it out on the market for our tanks. Now, if they were buying it at a retail outlet, you're correct. I think, I don't know, 60 cents, 50 cents probably difference a lot of times. But when we're buying it for the tanks, which is where most of the ethanol is being used for state vehicles, it's we buy it on the market, and we're not getting that good of a price break from the wholesalers.
I suspect, and Jeff can nod if this is correct, but isn't it because the margin on the E85 is not as great on the bottom end, but you're getting a better deal on the other fuel? I mean, that's where the break is coming, is the other fuel. Yeah.
The other issue is...
Come on up. That's all right. Thank you, Jim. Thanks, Commissioner.
One of the other things that goes into our bids is there are no federal taxes included in our pricing.
Correct.
And there's a wide difference between E85 and regular gasoline for federal taxes. So that 18 and a half cents or whatever it is helps lower our difference in pricing.
Solberg. Representative Solberg, do you still have another question? No? Okay. All right. Senator Haverly has a question, and you may not want to answer this. This is from Representative Kirkaby, so maybe we'll give you the noon hour to think this through, but go ahead, Senator Haverly.
And in actuality, I think it'd be helpful, since you did such a good job with the color coding on those other answers, that it'd be helpful that we had a little bit of background, and you can just respond probably in the same method in written and electronic form if you want. He had two questions, and one is, and you might be able to answer this right away, is when and how long has Bureau of Administration been in existence?
Okay. I don't know the answer to that.
That's interesting. I don't know, it's statehood or anyway. And then the other one is, and this one I think is relevant to this committee's task, and I think it happens many times when we do these sunset reviews, not so much to shut down an agency, but Representative Kirkaby will make reference to that in the question. I'll just go ahead and read it. It does appear that BOA is undertaking administrative responsibilities and duties that a traditional office or department should be doing themselves. I would think that if BOA is actually doing so much for departments and the governor's agencies, how can we justify the continued and status quo for other departments? It does appear on the surface that we may have too much administrative support on board with all those other levels of government. If that is not the case, should we draft a bill to eliminate BOA? And he ends it with, these questions both need to be asked and answered. And I think what I would ask you to do is if I can give you some homework, go back and answer it in the terms of justifying BOA's existence, and I think you'll be fine. The question always does arise as to when you have state agencies doing a particular job, and I have to be very careful because I've been very impressed with, you know, all the inner. I've been impressed with the whole briefing, with the inner groups that are under your control, Commissioner, and I learn something all the time. But I think in the broader picture, we have a lot of state agencies doing some things that we wonder, why aren't they under BOA, or role reversed, why isn't BOA doing that? And I think if you could maybe type up a 50-page, I'm just kidding, color-coded, a response to those. I'll give you this sheet so you guys can have it instead of having to go back and listen.
I'll be happy to do that. I guess in general, I would comment that that's something what BOA has done historically has changed over time and will continue to evolve. For example, until somewhere in the Janklow administration, the IT function was over in the Bureau of Administration. In some states, it still is in their general services operation. But as time went on during the 90s and computers became more and more important in terms of our operation, Governor Janklow made the decision that I want that off in a separate agency because I think that's just kind of a unique function, which is not unlike other states. John made a good point about the fleets. Until Governor Janklow took a look at it and said, you know what, instead of having everybody operating their own separate fleet, let's get it all under one roof because there's some economies there. And that will change. I mean, over time, there'll be other areas, and we're always looking at, is it better for us to be doing this versus somebody else? You know, there's some functions that just nobody else does, you know, taking care of the building, the Capitol building and the other buildings here. I'd hate to have social services go off and hire their own plumbers and electricians and et cetera. So some of those things are obvious. But some of the bigger things, there's a lot of states that have fleet, which every campus and every agency has their own fleet. And, you know, Representative Putnam pointed out how that didn't work very well. So, yeah, I'd be happy to put some together.
And along with that, and this is sort of your precursor to the appropriations process, if I'm reelected and am there and then put on appropriations, I think, you know, it's important that you show where the efficiencies and the cost efficiencies are as it pertains to somebody in an agency not doing that job. So many times, as you know, we hear on appropriations how somebody else is going to do it more effectively, more efficiently, and they're going to pull somebody out of a department or put somebody in a department, whichever way, you know, it rolls, and we never see that person being pulled out or that person being pulled in. So it's hard to get our hands around an agency such as yours because it covers so many different areas. And so a little precursor to next year, if I'm not there, I'll make sure somebody does ask it. So thank you, Mr. Commissioner.
Please.
One more response.
Absolutely.
We're going to have a new governor, and they have the prerogative to come in with an executive order and reorganize all of state government. And that did happen between Governor Janklow and Governor Rounds, and some departments disappeared. The functions of BOA could, or any of the bureaus could change too as a result of that too. So what we might be looking at come January might be totally or somewhat different than what we're talking about now.
Absolutely.
Good point.
Good. All right. Well, it's 5 to 12. Let's break for lunch. We'll be back in promptly go at 1. I think just to clarify, we will not quit it to if we still have questions and or discussion. Likewise, if we're done discussing at 1:30, we'll head out and do the tour then. So we'll be a little bit fluid this afternoon. I would expect between 2 and 2:30, we should be on the road out to Fleet and to Records. So be back in your chair at 1, and we will go from then. The committee is now in recess.
And the activities that the agency review committees get involved in, he mentioned the fact that what we like to do when we're doing this review is to take a look at the statutes that the agencies administer, to take a look at, you know, whether there's any style and form changes we can do to those statutes, if there's any dead wood in there that we can prune out, and basically do a review. And so that's what I've been working with Commissioner Bloomberg. As you know, this last session there was a major rewrite of the chapters dealing with procurement, which was embodied in House Bill 1046, and that involved the repeal of four chapters that the Bureau administers, and new legislation was passed, and it reorganized some of that language. It wasn't all new language, but it was an opportunity to clean up some archaic language at that time. And so that probably results in a bill that's probably half the size what it would have been. So what I passed out to you are two pieces of legislation. The first one I like to talk about is the larger one, which is the 0001, and that would be the cleanup. And I know some of you have been involved in review committees in the past, so I don't know if I need to go into real depth as to what we do as far as style and form. But basically, we're just trying to make it so it's a little bit more readable, use an active voice, use a singular voice. We go in and try to make it gender neutral, try to avoid pronouns, try to make simple sentences. And so that's what I've been doing. So what you have in front of you today is sections that some of the sections are sections that Commissioner Bloomberg brought to your attention last meeting, and then the other ones are the style and form that I've done, plus some other sections that I just wanted to bring to your attention. What this is this is just a rough draft. There's still things that are probably going to be included in this. There's going to be changes made to it, and we hope to be able to do that within the next couple of weeks so that you have it, you know, to look at a couple of weeks before your final meeting. So there are going to be some changes. But what I could do is just briefly go through it and show you where the things that Commissioner Bloomberg mentioned last meeting, where they're located, and then just a few things that I wanted to highlight for you.
Yep, that's a good idea.
First of all, with the issue dealing with the state seal, I'll defer that to the very end because that's embodied in the second bill that I have. And the reason I did that is because really that bill will not deal with the Bureau of Administration anymore. It'd be a Secretary of State issue, so I think it would be best to have that into a separate bill. If you look at the bill, the first page where you have sections dealing with the State Centennial Commission, those are the sections that Commissioner Bloomberg had mentioned in his action issue number 2. So that's where you find those, is on that first page. On the second page, in section 6, that's dealing with their action issue 3, which is removes the requirement for offices in the state capitol building. So that's where that's located. Issue number 4, dealing with the qualifications of the commissioner, that's found in section 7. Action issue number 5, which deals with the functions of the Bureau of Administration, that's found in section 12 on page 3 and then following. And as you recall, Commissioner Bloomberg proposed some language to spell out the general powers and duties of the Bureau in a more organized fashion. And that's the new language is found beginning on page 5. And we're still working on that to make sure we got everything covered there.
Okay.
On page 6, section 14, that's the repeal of the joint power statutes, which was their issue number 6. On page 7, the collection statutes, which was their action number 7, you find that on section 16 and 17. And then go to page 11. Page 11, sections 29 is their issue number 8, dealing with Capital Communications under BIT, not under BOA anymore. And then I also want to mention, the new language there is in section 30, the proposed new language, which would take out of 4.8.18 the reference to the mail system and put that under the Bureau of Administration.
Mm-hmm.
And then on page 12, section 33 is the action issue number 9 dealing with the construction revolving fund being repealed. And then we get to chapter 4. 515, which deals with the state capitol and the grounds, and some of that language has been around for a long time. And so you'll see going through there that we're taking out language dealing with the Capitol Complex Restoration and Beautification Commission. That commission is defined in a section, so we don't need to repeat all those, so we're just putting in commission. Issue number 10, which was regarding Governor's Grove, and that was, like I said, issue number 10 in Commissioner Bloomberg's list is found on page 23, line 68. And what I tried to do there was just to kind of put into words what is currently there now, that the Governor's Grove is located, it's north of Church Street in Hilders Gulch, and it's off to the left as you go into the gulch, in case you've never been there. Then I just wanted to bring your attention to, on page 23, sections 69, 70, and 71 is language that's in 515 that deals with a freedom memorial. This was language that was passed back in 1970 and appears that it's no longer applicable. So I'm just showing this as being repealed, but you know, I don't know if that's going to be controversial to anybody or not. But that's the reasoning behind that, is because it's been on the books since 1970 and it really hasn't been implemented. Kind of one that fits into that same category is on page 24, section 73. At one time, legislation was put into place that required a nursing office in the Capitol building. And at one time, that was done, but it's since not been used. So I just show that as being repealed. And then the following section deals with that. And then another one that kind of fits into that category would be on page 26, section 82. There's a section in there that deals with the statute of General Beadle, and it says that it should be in the rotunda. And at one time, it was controversial back at the time of the centennial, when those statues that are in the statuary hall closed down on the rotunda. Governor Mickelson had those commissioned for the centennial, those four statues that there. Prior to that, the bust of Peter Norbeck and the statue of General Beadle were in those spots. And so there was concern at the time as to where those were going to be located. And so legislation was passed at that time. There was concern by some that General Beadle should stay in the rotunda, and so that's the reason this language was put in there. And I don't know if you've noticed where General Beadle is located now. He's not located in the rotunda. So I just bring that to your attention. You know, you might want to address that or may not, but I just want you be aware that it is in statute. And then on page 28, this one's section 88 is kind of related to, issue number 3, which dealt with the offices being in the Capitol building. There's a requirement that there be a supply room in the Capitol building, and that, as you know from our tour last time, that the supplies really are not located in the Capitol building. So what you're seeing is a repeal of what's in the law now in 88 and then a redrafting of language that is probably necessary in section 89. On page 29, we got some language there being repealed that really it's passed. It's already been implemented, so it's no longer necessary. And then on page 30 is just some sections I wanted to bring to your attention. Sections 94 through 98, these are in the state motor pool sections. Section 94 was legislation that was passed back in 1978, and it dealt with self-service stations. Well, I don't think there's many full service stations anymore, but that's on the book, and so you might want to consider repealing that. Sections 95 through 97 were all, or through 98 were all legislation that was passed back in 1943, and a lot of those are no longer applicable. The Board of Finance sets, you know, those fees and policies as far as state travel is concerned, and that's in 391. So the one issue that I don't have in this draft that Commissioner Bloomberg brought up was the section dealing with the Capitol Police being under the board or under the Bureau of Administration, and now that function is under public safety. That's not included in here, but we will include that repeal. And then beginning on lines or pages 32 through the rest of the document, that is pretty much, that's all sections that are sections that didn't get addressed by 1046 that basically clean up internal cross-references to sections. So,
and Dave, it all looks like it's just literally clean up in the rest of those.
Well, the intent is that this would be there won't be any controversy over these. That's the intent. But some of these, you know, might.
Senator Haverly.
And back to page 34 on section 71, and you made note of this when you were briefing us, the Division of Veterans Affairs. Explain that a little bit more, why that should be stricken. I mean, I'm reading through it.
34.
It's on, page 23, section 71. Okay. Looks like line 22. I understand line 16 in that section, but I'm not quite following why this would be stricken as far as the contributions.
Well, the question is whether this is needed anymore at all.
I think I just grabbed it. Yeah, it's on that particular memorial.
Right. Yeah, so it's, you know, a question as to whether those three sections are needed anymore. And you know, in discussions with Commissioner Bloomberg, we couldn't come up with any good reasons, but there might be some
out there. Do they still receive contributions to upkeep the memorial at all, or make, I mean, I'm not going to make additions to it, but...
I'm not aware of maybe.
Or does anybody ever solicit, I guess, for it?
I'm not aware of any contributions, and should probably check with military and vets on that, but there doesn't appear to be any reason to get contributions at this point in time for that. The only memorials that we're involved with are the ones that are done at the Capitol Lake, didn't get contributions during the construction phase of that, but haven't since.
Fifth follow-up, Mr. Chair. So if there are contributions, how are those dispersed? Or if they are coming through the Veterans Affairs, what's the mechanics for...
That's something I'll have to explore with them to find out if in fact, they have gotten any donations in the past, or if they're getting them where they're going.
And then, yeah, and as a side note, then maybe we need to, at that point, relook at how that is in statute, or how we work that. But
yep.
Okay. And I am glad to see that the qualifications for the commissioner have been lowered, just in case those of us who want that job someday.
There's a long line. I'm sorry. Go ahead, David.
So basically, this would be the cleanup legislation, and as I indicated, there was a section in there dealing that we're cleaning up with that, in dealing with the cross references, it looks like to make a long story short, we're just going to have to check with the PUC to see if they think it's needed or not. We think that it could be repealed, because updating the cross-reference makes no sense, because it's regards something that happened in the past. So I just need to check with them to make sure that it's okay. To repeal. But this is where we're at. I don't foresee us adding a lot of new sections, but there may be some as far as cleanup. And like I indicated, we still need to tweak this. It still needs to go through our review process in-house, but hopefully we have that done in a couple weeks, so that, you know, what we can do is, you know, post it out there on our website so you can take a look at it and or however you want to handle it.
Okay.
You know?
Representative Wismar has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 30, you're repealing from 525.3 through 525.7. Tell me again, that's because all of that's handled someplace else in the code. Is that what you're saying?
I believe so, and once again, we'll have to double check and make sure that's the case. But this was language that was put in the books back in 1943, and you know, as you read through it, it talks about the governor, fixing the rate for the use of private owned vehicles and such. Well, there's other legislation that's passed since then that, you know, gives that to the Board of Finance to do that. So,
okay.
You know, in just going over it, we think that's already all covered, you know, under what they do. But, you know, we'll double check and make sure that's the case.
And the fact that there's no full service islands left in the entire state. So, all right. Any other questions? Okay, go ahead, Dave.
And then the other bill that we had put together is the one dealing with the use of the state seal. And all I did there was took the language that Commissioner Bloomberg gave us and then put it into our style and form. And I guess the intent, I think he's already had the Secretary of State take a look at it, but, you know, he would be here at your next meeting or somebody from the office, you know, to give comments about that, so.
Okay. Let's make sure he's at the next meeting, too. Okay.
All right. I guess, you know, the plan would be to get this done in the next couple of weeks, put it out there, check with these other departments, and then, you know, have the opportunity at the next meeting for, you know, people to come in and talk about it and we find out maybe if some of these are more controversial than what I think they are, but and then go from there. The interim review committee, you know, would approve the bill and determine, you know, whether it's going to be a Senate bill or a House bill and who the sponsors are going to be at that time. So.
Okay, good. Questions on the second bill? I think we'll have the Secretary of State up here. We'll make sure he's here for the next meeting to discuss that. Representative Solberg.
Thank you. I didn't read the bill in entirety, but what about if we want to use the state seal on our legislative business card? Is there a fee, and do we have to get permission?
I can answer that one. No and yes. No fee, yes permission.
He knows more than I do on that subject.
Well, I only know that because I've done it, so, yeah, you have to... At the time, I contacted Secretary of State's office, which lends itself to why this is a discussion now, and got approval, and there is no fee, but you do have to get a written letter. So, questions? Okay, that's it then.
Okay.
Thanks, David. Okay. Let's see. Commissioner, do you have anything else you'd like to go over before we start winding down here?
Mr. Chairman, there is one other item I just want to give you a briefing on. Currently, if you look on the back side of the Department of Transportation, our ground shop is located in a shop that's right across the street. And it's where snow plows and that type of thing are kept and mowers, et cetera. That is actually owned by the Pierce School District. Back in during the Janklow administration, there was a trade made that would allow them or allow us to use that school district property. And in return, they have been using a shop that's up on the bypass for school district maintenance equipment. And both sides figured that was a better location for both of them. We were informed, and I did talk to the Appropriations Committee about this last winter, but the bottom line is that the school district is going to want that building back down here for their use. And in our discussions with them, we said, well, you know, give us some time, and essentially what they've said is we'll give you till the end of calendar year 2011. So we've got this year and next year to figure out a location for our equipment. If push came to shove, the option would be to put all that stuff out on the bypass, which is a long ways to be trailering or driving lawnmowers back and forth. So it is an issue that we've got to get figured out, and we're looking at different alternatives, and it's something that we would hope to have some kind of a solution for when the session starts, because it's either going to involve a new shop or finding a lease property that potentially we could use, or again going back out under the bypass. So I think it's the one kind of capital improvement thing that we need to look at.
Commissioner, are you talking about the snowblowers, lawnmowers, the brushes, all that?
Exactly. Yep.
Hmm. Yeah.
And just a little history for those that haven't been around that long, Before that, all of that equipment was stored down in what is now the visitor center right next to Capitol Lake. So before that change was made, you had snow equipment, mowers, and all that stuff down there around the Capitol Lake. When that was renovated for use as a visitor center and also for meeting rooms, et cetera, all that equipment came away from the lake. And, you know, aesthetically, I hate to go back and have to stick all that stuff back in there. But
yeah, I don't think that's probably a very good option. Yeah. Representative Feichert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How many square feet building are you in, and is that sufficient?
The building we're in is sufficient now. I would say yes to that. And Christie's actually been working. Do you remember with the square footage by chance? Don't. You might, if you ever get a chance, just to drive by there and take a look. It's not a very big building, and it does appear to be sufficient as far as our use right now. So we wouldn't be looking for something.
Go ahead.
In terms of extra space.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there land or property closer to the proximity of the Capitol building to put a building? Or
there really isn't. You know, we've had some discussions with the school district. Would there be interest in allowing us to build right next to the current shop? I haven't got a yes or a no on that. But, again, that would be a new building. So there's some expenditure involved in that. We've looked up on the north end of the campus, on the north end of Hilger's Gulch. There is some property up there that runs along what's 4th Street, kind of right across from where the soccer fields are up there. That's potential location. We've also looked at and had discussions with one of the landlords that we're dealing with currently about the possibility if he'd be interested in renovating it and letting us use that as a shop. But other than those three locations, and actually I should say we talked to the city about some of their property that's adjacent to us. Otherwise, we're pretty well landlocked by school district or private property.
Are you thinking of one of the options when the school district moves their stuff out of our building on the bypass? Are we looking at maybe selling that property and kind of then utilizing some of those resources to build a new building?
Well, that would be an option. That space up there, if we weren't using it, that potentially that could be sold and you could use that funds for another building.
Or maybe the school district wants to buy it and keep storing their stuff there. I don't know.
Well, in addition to this shop over here, they've built another new maintenance shop for themselves. So they're not looking for anything.
They must have a lot of stuff break down.
Apparently. I don't know.
All right. Yeah, it sounds like you're already in discussion with the Appropriations Committee about long-term fix to that. So, good. All right. Anything else for the commissioner while we still have him up here? I guess not. You're off the hook.
Okay.
A couple things for the committee then before we wrap. We will plan on meeting on October 5th. Sue has informed me that all of the documents are online. That we anything that we have that she's printed is online, so you can go find it there anytime you want as well. So we'll plan on October 5th. I think at this point we're looking at probably a 9 o'clock meeting, and I would suspect what we'll do then is between now and then, your task will be if there's any particular legislation that you would like to see that deals with the BOA. And anything under their oversight, you could or should have that drafted by that next meeting by October 5th. We will discuss it. We'll obviously vote on these two pieces after we see a final copy. And those will come out, you know, probably more than likely will come out of here as a committee proposal, piece of legislation. And then if there's something individually you'd like to see again, just make sure you get in touch with Sue and she'll get you in touch with the appropriate staff to get those drafted before the next meeting in October. I don't foresee that October meeting being a very long meeting. I think we might even probably schedule it from 9 to noon and you know, kind of see. That gives us some time on the backside. If we need to, we can continue to have meeting that day. We'll probably open it up further. We'll have some public testimony. We'll also discuss these two bills plus any bills that any member brings at that time. So I don't see it being a long day, but I think a good way to wrap up. Good way to wrap up the review. The commissioner at that time will also probably answer the question that Senator Haverly through Representative Kirkaby asked and have a packet for us then as well. Anything else from the committee before we continue to move on? Is there anything you'd like from the commissioner for the next meeting that you've not received? Representative Solberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not right offhand, but if, after thinking about it, I would like information, do I just contact them?
I would, why don't you just go through Sue, and
okay.
She'll take care of all that groundwork for you. So,
thank you.
Yeah, you bet. I was going to end with that. If there's something that pops up after today in your mind on the way home, you go, oh, I wish I'd have thought of that. Get a hold of Sue. She'll make sure the commissioner and his staff know and get it handled. So. Well, good. I think we're making good progress. We got everything, you know, your departments are all covered and things are moving along quite well. I think at this point, if you'd want to come up and give us directions to where we're going to go from here, we'll adjourn the meeting officially, and then we will go do our tour of the facilities. And at that point, we'll be done and then just go on about your way.
Both of the fleet and the records people are all co-located out at the Department of Transportation facility out on the bypass. The easiest way to get there is just to go on Capitol Avenue down to the S-curve, take a left out to the bypass where about Ashley Furniture is on your left, go up the hill about a half a mile, and it's on your right side. You can't miss it once you're out there. Okay. When you get into the DOT through the gates there, you'll see the pumps, fuel pumps straight ahead, and we're the second building on your left. The one is the regional DOT is the first one, and then the second one would be where the fleet people and records are located.
Fuel up as long as we're there.
Only if you put in E85. All right, good. Everyone clear on where we're going? So we go down by the car dealership, that corner, curve, go north, up past the Walmart, take a left at the bypass corner. Kind of, if you were heading out to the Attorney General's building.
No. Yeah, like you're heading out towards Walmart.
If you get by Ashley, you hang a left.
Yeah, right at
Ashley Furniture, take a left.
Ashley
okay.
Furniture, and then you, you're going towards Walmart.
Yep.
Right.
Oh, on that road towards the Walmart. Okay, all right, good. All right.
I know I was going.
Okay. Any other business for the committee? If not, we need a motion to adjourn.
So moved. Second.
Moved by Feigert. Second by Teason. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion carries. We are adjourned.